Remember, my friends, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking fact about
Radio Mysterioso?
What is all that noise? And every time I come in here, all the little knobs are all changed because it's fun to change knobs. The only thing that should be changed is the host's microphone has to have the bass turned up just slightly so he sounds more macho. See, there's a difference between... Wait.
Welcome to Radio Mysterioso. Between that and...
Welcome to Radio Mysterioso. See the difference? All you have to do is turn up the bass. Just there we go. Just slightly. There's a lot. Radio Mysterioso. And so the guests today will have their treble turned way up. Pretty scary. It's Radio Mysterioso here for December 7th. Happy Pearl Harbor Day, 2008. Yes? Yes, that's right. It happened on a Sunday. Always on a Sunday. If you read Paul Kimbo's blog, or did you put on Facebook too? Oh, is that working?
I did. And if you turn the treble up, there's going to be trouble. And then we'll have trouble with trebles.
There we go.
My God, Greg, the treble is up.
Paul and I both announced this in multiple places. Paul Kimball is author, raconteur, filmmaker, and all-around dude from Halifax, Nova Scotia, president of Red Star Films, who produced a video film presentation that you probably know about called Best Evidence, the Top 10 UFO Sightings, which won an EBE award from the International UFO Congress Film Festival. And Paul was like leaning forward. Don't screw this up.
Make sure you get it right. I don't win many awards.
Yes. And he's been, as I said on the post, he's Roddy Mysterioso's Richard Hoagland, basically, because he's been on so many times. He thought it was Walter, but Walter's basically a co-host. Walter's here, too. And I don't know. I said Richard Hoagland. I thought he was going to go, what? What?
As long as I'm not the Linda Moulton Howe of Radio Mysterioso. So
Whoa, that's nice. Is that working?
No. As long as I'm not the Linda Moulton Howe of Radio Mysterioso, I'm fine.
I don't know how you could
Tim Benall.
Yeah, I don't know how you could be. And also, as promised, our other guest is Holly Stevens, who is his co-host on, what's the name of the show, the program?
It's currently working as Maritime Ghosts.
Okay. It's a program on Maritime Ghosts in the Maritime Provinces of Canada and also, I guess, in the Northeastern U.S.
Actually, Maritime Ghosts was the original title, but I think, you know, that is a working title, so at the end of the day... we'll have a different title. We're going to be shooting, it looks like, in the U.S., at least 4 or 5 episodes, L.A., San Diego, Savannah, Georgia, maybe New Orleans. So,
okay.
So yeah, it's not just going to be the Maritime Provinces.
All over the place. Also, I did not finish with Holly's introduction. She's also one of the stars of Eternal Kiss, which is the vampire movie that just finished principal photography about a month and a half ago in Shelburne, which apparently we will never return to again. As I said on the blog space that what did I say about it? Oh yes, I was a production supervisor. and something that I hadn't exactly done before, but the job presented itself very quickly, whatever responsibilities were. Anything nobody else wants to do, including deal with incredibly insane people to fix people's plumbing, I got to do that. So, oh, and also location managed, too. That was fun. Anyway, they're both here today. They're going to talk about the Ghost Show, some stuff that happened to them on the Ghost Show so far, Maritime Ghosts, and also Paul's recent return to blogging about UFOs, which he said he wasn't going to do anymore a few months ago. how's the show going? How many do you have to go? And how the hell did you get this deal?
Oh, wait. Wait, that sorry.
Uh-oh. You know what? Let me give you my microphone.
There you go.
Crazy, man. Crazy. All right. We're all based up now, Holly. This is great. This is very odd. Folks at home can't see exactly the sort of social dynamic of the studio.
There we go.
Yeah.
Let me turn your bass down. There's mine. There you go.
it's a show we have in production with a regional network up in Canada called Eastlink. Distribution, international distribution through another company out of Toronto. And my partner and I, Dale Stevens, who's the producer and co-director, he came up with the idea. He wanted to do a show on ghost hunting or ghost investigations. And we had originally assembled a team of investigators, very good investigators from Halifax, called Grim Undertakings. And after shooting the pilot episode, we decided two things. One, they were very good ghost investigators, but they weren't made for television in the sense that television requires sometimes, you know, you to make a few sacrifices, not in the objectivity or the reality of your investigation, but it's entertainment. And they were more concerned about the serious investigation, to their credit. And I'm concerned about that too, but I'm also, you have to entertain. It's a half-hour long television show. So we parted ways very amicably. They continued to investigate. And Dale and I, sort of in a walk in the woods on a snowy evening, a la Robert Frost, decided that I should host the show because I am something of a paranormal guru. And
Who determined that?
I did. So I almost said that with a straight face. Hey, how many EBE awards do you have? So
I don't want one.
Yeah. So then we said, well, look, the one thing that Paul has is the paranormal bona fides, but he's ugly as sin and not terribly telegenic. So we have to bring somebody on the show who's good-looking, glamorous, and also
female.
Intelligent, has an interest in the paranormal, and yes, you a woman, so that you could have that Mulder, Scully, Sybil Shepherd, Bruce Willis kind of back-and-forth banter. And we call Sybil Shepherd, and she wasn't available, so Holly was our second choice. We had Holly ahead of Gillian Anderson, so Holly was, that's how Holly got the gig.
They both have red hair.
Yeah, well, true. And Holly had worked, as you said, Holly had worked with us on Eternal Kiss and did a fine job both in front of the camera and behind the camera. She worked on the crew, but she also played Sophie Price, the mother of the main character, in a flashback scene where she got her neck broken. So anybody who can act
in front of a fire where people got smoke inhalation.
Exactly.
Yes.
Including me.
Yeah.
So that's how we get the ghost thing, and we've done three episodes so far, with 10 more to go.
Holly, did you start out being the guest? Like, I mean, the guest, right? You're my guest. The co-host, or great, that's broken now.
Minor technical difficulties.
Yes. There it is. Jeez, did you start out being? Were you hired on right away as a co-host? And, you know, was it a, like, plan thing? Or are you just like, here, Holly, you be the co-host and we're going to look for ghosts? Or there's a lot of backgrounding and...
Well, it was pretty much a having coffee with Paul kind of thing. And Paul's like, hey, so how would you like to co-host a ghost show? And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, really? And I was like, oh my gosh, that would be awesome. Absolutely awesome. So it was very, very last minute, spur of the moment. Got thrown in there, and I've been having a blast ever since.
Yeah, earlier we were talking, I said, well, is there like some, you know, there's not really any scripting or anything like that. But then we were talking about it, and it's like, you have to act differently in front of a camera than you would, you know, oh, there was something startling.
Oh, yeah.
You kind of have to overplay it, at least you were telling me.
Well, it depends what kind of thing they're looking for. There was a time when Paul wanted to jump out and scare me, and actually successfully did it numerous times. It's kind of his running thing right now.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's great. And that's usually how I respond. But once in a while, he gets me, and I actually do. I don't ever scream, but it definitely frightens me. I mean, it's Paul, after all.
I don't think anybody actually screams except in movies.
Well, exactly.
Or if they're being murdered, I guess. I mean,
yeah, this show's going to go.
Probably can't hear Paul unless you have your gain up really high.
No, that's right. You want to lean in closer, Paul?
No.
Okay, well, I saw in some emails that once in a while people are saying, oh, something just happened the other day. Maybe there really are ghosts. And I was like thinking, what happened? Did a ghost fly in front of you? Or what has happened besides the normal shows? I mean, you're looking for ghosts, but has anything happened that made you go, whoa, wait a second?
Sure, lots of things have happened that make me go, whoa, wait a second.
How do you know it's John, just Paul screwing around with you?
You don't always, actually. Yeah, there's been a number of things that have happened. I mean, 95% of them you can explain rationally, logically, as something else. There's been a few things where you really have to stop and go, now, wait a second, this just doesn't add up. There's something else going on here.
And we you know, we use the tools of the trade that... that all ghost hunters use. If you watch Ghost Hunters on Sci-Fi or whatever network it's on, History Channel, I don't know what network it's on down here, you know, audio tape recorders to get anomalous
possible
audio.
EVP, yeah.
Yeah, they call it EVP, and I hate that. I use anomalous audio phenomenon. We use multiple cameras in specific sites that witnesses have said they've seen something or experienced something, and we set the cameras up and we record for a period of time. And then we have a segment that we started to call Spooky Time with Holly and Paul, where we basically lock ourselves in a haunted room or haunted house or whatever, and everybody else
with
goes away.
No,
the crew goes away. And we're there with the audio recorders, the cameras on us, and we wait anywhere between, 45 minutes to 2 hours.
Well, you got
to
wait all night, man.
Well, no. Again, it's television. You have the exigencies of production. But even within those...
It's okay. You can say anything you want at any time.
Even within those limited time frames, we've recorded some weird things, and we've actually had one or two potentially weird things happen to us. So, and I'm skeptical, as you know, about the paranormal in any respect. I'm very skeptical, but open-minded. So we have these audio recordings, and there was one... restaurant in Halifax, actually, where a witness had said that she had seen the ghost of a little girl in the ladies' bathroom. So Holly and I, it's sort of been a dream of mine. I spent a fair amount of time in the ladies' washroom that night. And
without having to be invisible.
Exactly. And, you know, they don't have urinals. I did not know that.
Whoa!
Seriously?
Doesn't make sense.
Seriously.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that. But while we were there, we had the tape recorders on, and later when they were reviewing the audio... And we had something weird, and I don't want to tell you what weird thing happened because, it's television. We got to keep that for the show. But on the audio later, they picked up some very odd noises around the time that something physical happened. And one of the things, pretty much everyone who's heard it agrees, sounds like a little girl's voice saying, "Mommy." And this restaurant is where many of the victims of both the Titanic disaster and the Halifax explosion in 1917 were taken because before it was a restaurant, it was a funeral home and mortuary. So many of the victims from both of those disasters were located there. Now it's one of Halifax's posher restaurants, the Five Fishermen. So anyway, that's kind of one of those weird things. And in a recent post on UFOs, I was just saying the same thing. Maybe ufology can learn a lot from ghost hunters, where you should actually be out using instruments that can try and obtain some form of measurable data, whatever that is, so that at least you have something you can look at besides just witness testimony.
And blurry video. But the thing is, ghosts show up on a fairly regular schedule. Well, the thing, not regular, but they show up regularly in places where people have reported them. UFOs, it lasts for a while and then goes away.
Not true. Stephen Greer can call them down at will.
That's true.
On that overnight thing.
Here, give that one doesn't cut out, so why don't you give that
one? I was just going to ask on the thing you did where you were in the place, could you do like an overnighter and then you just take the highlights
you could edit
of anything that happened with editing? You might catch some really cool shit like after the late hours.
Well, usually when we are there, we're there till 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, so a good 12 hours. We're there doing interviews, walkthroughs.
I mean, we've basically usually got a day or two to shoot a show. So you've got to, and one of the things that we really treasure is every episode we have to have primary witnesses, at least one or two people who've actually said they've seen or experienced something. So you're not getting secondhand stories like, oh, in 1942, Ed the farmer experienced a talking donkey or something. Or the ghost of a talking donkey. So these are people like the lady in the washroom. She was a server at the restaurant who actually claimed to have experienced things.
Yeah.
So we have to interview them. And the other thing, too, is hopefully as people who have seen my films know, there's a way of shooting a documentary series where – and Ghost Hunters, not to knock them, but they do that herky-jerky camera. They're using multiple cameras, which we're not. We're using one HD camera. It's a very small crew. But also there's I prefer a certain well-lit, well-staged, fluid, you know, Errol Morris kind of documentary look as opposed to somebody just putting a camera on their shoulder and running around. And the other thing that really bugs me about these ghost hunting shows, sorry, I'm off on a tangent.
No, you should.
This idea, you see people, I mean, Holly and I joke about how we ramp it up just a little bit, but not much. But I was watching some ghost hunting show for kids. It was on Canadian TV, but I think it's a sci-fi thing. I don't know. And she's like, here I am. I'm in the basement. And she's got like eight cameras on. It's like, I'm so scared. And I'm thinking, what are you scared of? That they're going to fire you for overacting? Because you probably got a signed contract. You'll be fine. So that kind of stuff, you know, we like to make sure that the shots are right, that it's well lit.
No, it wasn't
just so
Polly.
That we can see what we're doing. And that only really leaves us usually an hour or two for spooky time. Although we did do a haunted inn, allegedly haunted inn, where we set up the cameras in our bedrooms. Holly and I had separate rooms. And so
what?
And you had cameras in each room recording us even as we slept. And I don't know what those cameras recorded yet, but they might have recorded something.
It's going to show up on YouTube.
Well, Holly was really weirded out in that episode, too. I didn't feel anything, but Holly and a couple of our crew members, just the place, freaked him out a bit. So I'll let Holly talk about that.
Well, I think everyone but you is creeped out, Paul. You don't feel anything.
That's true.
I am Mr. Spock. Yes.
There's a logical explanation for all of this.
One would assume. With the episode that we did at the, it was a mansion. It was actually Churchill's mansion in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. I've been to a number of different places, and this one I can't explain it any more than it had a really strange feeling about it, like layers of emotion now from the people that were there, the people that have been there, and the people that are there, I think. It's just layered with, what would you call it?
Emotion.
Thank you, Paul. That was fantastic. No, so even as a...
I can see what's going on in the show kind of here now. Paul's like, no, it's nothing. And Holly is, well, there's layers of emotion.
There's this great thing. She was a little weirded out, and she was up in her bedroom, and Dale Stevens, my co-producer and co-director, there's a portrait of one of the ladies, what's her name? Lottie Churchill, who supposedly haunts the house, and she might have murdered somebody there. It's a long story. Anyway, the owner of the inn says, anytime we move the portrait, weird things happen. So we leave it here because we anger Lottie if we move the portrait.
So you had to move it.
So what does Paul do? Yeah. Paul takes the portrait off the wall, brings it up to my bedroom. I don't even know this. I'm in there. The camera guy's like, oh, we're going to go shoot this. So Paul's going to knock on the door. I'm like, great, great, great. And there he is, holding it like it's possessed, floating midair and saying my name, Holly. And yeah, so they decided that night that they would leave the portrait, the haunted portrait, in the haunted room.
That was gold, by the way. Cinematic
in
gold.
The haunted room that I was sleeping in, and leave it on the bed facing me whilst I slept. Yes, yes, that was brilliant. Thank you very much for that, Paul.
You're welcome. And actually, we not only put Holly in a room with a haunted picture, or we brought a haunted rocking chair down from the attic that the owners of the inn had said.
Why is it haunted? Nobody, by itself, etc.
Exactly. So guests were getting so weirded out. They said, "Look, we're just going to put this in the attic and everything." So we said, "Well, of course, we'll bring it down and put it in Holly's room." So she was there with this haunted portrait looking at her, and a haunted rocking chair next to her,
and nothing happened.
And a haunted room where somebody might have been murdered, and even worse, down the hall, I was waiting. Anyway, so we put the painting back.
And nothing happened, right?
We don't know yet. We haven't reviewed the video
footage.
Well,
nothing consciously aware, in your conscious awareness happened is what I meant.
Well, there was a number of different experiences that I had while I was there. Nothing that was necessarily physical. No one, like, attacked me, or I didn't see anything really spooky in the mirror or reflected in a portrait or anything like that. But all I can really explain is that it was just strange feelings. Immediately when I came in the room and sat down in what was Lottie's room, where she apparently killed someone. Oh, yeah, it was great. It just was there. There was the air was thick, but it was cold. It shouldn't have been thick. It shouldn't have been close the way it was. There was a couple of things that drew my attention in the room. One was a corner, which I know, corner. But later I found out that apparently some people had seen this woman standing there. It was the haunted corner, which is, of course, where they put the rocking chair, too.
Seems like you tried to make things happen, and they just didn't really happen, at least not consciously.
Nothing happened. Like, I didn't see the rocking chair move.
Walter, too bad we didn't have Richard Sennett on at the same time here.
But you had a dream.
I did. That was actually very strange. I had a dream the first night I was there about Lottie, which apparently happens. Now, whether that's because the owners tell you all these interesting stories about her, I'm not sure. But
be interesting if it's the same dream.
No, it's not the same dream, actually. Apparently they're all different, so it's hard to say. But the dream I had was that Lottie was there. Actually, Paul and I were in the room speaking to Lottie, and there was a chair there, which actually then the next night was when they brought the rocking chair down. It's very strange.
Remote viewing.
Oh, but the first night that I was there, nothing really happened per se. I woke up several times in the night, just a feeling of something else being there. And I had to actually sit up in my bed and look around the room. I'm not sure why that helped, but it did. Instead of just kind of hiding and cowering under my covers. But later on in the night, I went to pull the blankets further up over me. And I felt there was a kind of a heavy presence next to me on the bed, like if someone, like a cat had been lying on the bed or something.
Right.
And I tried to pull them, but they were really heavy, and I just kind of had this feeling like there was somebody sitting on the bed next to me, but of course there was no one there.
Maybe it was the hag phenomenon. Are you familiar with that?
No.
About the heaviness on the chest, they call it hag
called
when it was
going back in the old hag, it's most pronounced in the history of Newfoundland, but also the Maritime Provinces in Canada, the United Kingdom. This old crotchety woman, a hag, who comes in and people wake up and sort of a waking sleep, see her sitting on their chest, they can't breathe, that kind of thing. It's very similar to the legends of the succubus, same kind of thing. And people, including Jacques Vallée and others, have drawn links, you know, between these folklore stories right up to alien abductions, and say that in our more technological age, we don't think of the old hag or the succubus anymore. We think of aliens from Zeta Reticuli or wherever Stan Friedman says they're from. So,
well, as Vallée says, it's not a be-all, end-all explanation, but it's something that should be considered, yeah.
Yeah, the patterns throughout the way that people tell stories. And so,
well, things are individualized for each person because it has to go through your consciousness before you experience it. Everybody experiences something a little bit differently.
Yeah, and that's, we had Mac Tonies. He was up in Halifax working on a documentary for a few days. And
A
different one. And Holly and Mac and I and Holly's brother Ben, who's a director in his own right, we sat down one night over a few drinks and we just talked about all the various possible things that ghosts or any of these paranormal phenomenon could represent. Yeah. And it was kind of like that show you and Mac and I did where you just this free-flowing discussion of everything from time travel to extra dimensions. Maybe people are trying to communicate with us from other dimensions, and ghosts are a manifestation of that in the same way that UFOs might be. And this is the weird thing. I prattle on, but one of the reasons that it annoys me a bit when people will say, we can't possibly consider UFOs in the same, like when Nick Redfern will do Bigfoot research and people will rag on Nick for doing, you undermine UFO research by talking about Bigfoot at the same time. Yes, quite. Well, maybe they are interrelated in some way, in some fashion. So if you're dealing with extra-temporal or extra-dimensional sort of creatures or whatever, maybe UFOs are one manifestation, maybe ghosts are another, maybe Bigfoot's another. You never know. So if you don't have answers to all of these questions, and I think what Holly and I will wind up doing is raising more questions than we answer, then it's just the same as UFOs or anything else. We've got questions. Let's leave the door open for all sorts of possible and maybe even plausible explanations.
Are you going to discuss this kind of stuff on the show?
On the DVD extras, yes. There'll be an extra bonus disc where I spend 5 hours boring people. So
with all the ideas that you stole from Nick, Mac, and I.
Exactly. But none of the ones
and everybody that we stole them from.
None of the ones I stole from Tim Banal. So yeah, you know, though at some point I think we will talk about those kind of things as the series goes along. But it's really about the stories of the witnesses and our own experiences. And one of the things that I don't know about Holly, she can talk about what she's looking for out of it. But one of the things, as soon as we decided that I was going to be one of the co-hosts, after years of being behind the camera, I hope in 13 episodes, all I want, and I might have already had one. We don't know. We're reviewing data and stuff from the Five Fishermen episode. But what I really want is, look, I'd like, you know, to see a ghost. I'd like something to touch me on the shoulder,
right,
whatever happened, except for Holly, who's doing it right now. You know, I'd like the old hag to come sit on my chest, although I would prefer a succubus. Definitely
who
not.
Would,
a,
who would? Who what? What? Yeah.
Definitely Walters not an incubus. Don't want one of those. But
gay
a
gay incubus.
A gay incubus, that sort of works, maybe.
For you?
No. For the incubus.
Yes.
But, you know, I hope something happens. I hope I experience something and gives me a reason to consider stop being a skeptic. Now, here's what Holly wants.
Well, actually, what I was going to say is that I think in order for you to experience that kind of thing, Paul, you have to open yourself up. And he's making weird noises now. I think you need to open yourself up to whatever that is. And I think it's a different sense. It's you can't always see or smell or feel. And now he's saying, okay, here you go.
Fine. I agree. And I am now on the radio saying, attention, all succubi. Wherever you may be, whatever dimension you're in, transtemporal, transdimensional, whatever universe, parallel universe, this universe, I don't care where you're from, attention, I'll suck you by. I am open for business. I am waiting for you. Come see me tonight.
That's disgusting.
You know, when it does happen, my convincing experience was an audible experience. Yeah. And the person who owned the house, it was a plantation house built in 1854 down in Montgomery, Alabama. Might be a location you guys might want to check out while you're down south, but the person who owned the house told me, had I gone downstairs, I definitely would have seen. It was a woman just weeping loudly, and I could hear it coming up from downstairs where the room she was in. And I wasn't scared. It was fascinating. I was hearing this woman weep just as clearly and real as you're hearing my voice, and I knew no one was downstairs. I mean, the people that I knew of in the house, we were all upstairs and they were all sleeping. And you know what? I'm definitely, if I had any doubts before, which I didn't have as much, I'm a believer after that.
Well, we left in the Churchill Mansion episode, we left a tape recorder. We do this every night. We'll leave tape recorders for and let them run for 6 or 7 hours till the batteries are out and then just review it later and see what we pick up. So I left one up in the Widow's Walk, this area of the house where the wives of the sea captains used to go up and watch to see if their husbands would come in from the storms or whatever, and let it run. And as the next day I went up, picked it up, and you know, you sort of say, look, I'm Paul Kimmel, this is 1 o'clock in the morning, and so you know you can count. If it's 9 minutes after that, it's 1:09. And it was 9 minutes after that, and I know what we were doing at 1:09. We were setting upstairs a shot. And so you playing this just for get a little bit, and all of a sudden on the tape, what my brother who was there as our line producer, Dale, my co-producer, and I, we all agree, sounds like a woman's scream, kind of thing, and it lasts for about a second or two, and then it's gone. Now and so I immediately I pick that up. I'm playing it. I go down, Jim, Dale, you know, like, do you guys hear this? And they're both, yeah, that's weird. And we know it's like at 1:09 that evening. Did anybody scream? No, we were upstairs. The only pathway up to that would have been us. The only women who were there were Holly and Mel, our Melissa Clattenburg, our production manager, and one witness, but she was downstairs. Couldn't have been any of us.
And no, so, nobody actually heard it.
And nobody heard it. That was the other thing, because we would have been. It was loud enough on the tape recorder that if somebody had been there, we would have heard it. And so, you know, we will analyze that. We'll take a look at it. We'll put it in some context and say, okay, what does that mean? And it so far, at least in two of the episodes.
This is factory. Is it digital recording or
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In at least two of the episodes, we have audio, anomalous audio phenomena. We haven't reviewed the Fortress Lewisburg episode yet. I don't know. But two out of three is pretty good. And then you sort of say,
I should have brought my EVP CD. I've got a CD called The Ghost Orchid. It's got something like an hour and 15 minutes of recordings of anomalous voices in seances, in haunted houses, on radios, shortwave radios. But people think, well, maybe this is something that's just coming through from the circuitry, you know, bleeding through like it does here when we hear this Mexican station for some strange reason occasionally.
It was on earlier before you got here.
Oh, yeah. But you read up on this and talk to people and look at the history of it. Some of these recordings, unless the people are lying, start to refer to the people that are doing the recordings. They'll say something personal about something that nobody else knows about, and that'll come out on the recording. And, you know, where does that come from? Unless they're lying. If you want to be a doctrinaire.
And you thought you were alone when you were doing that.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that would be one of the first questions somebody would ask. Well, maybe you're getting some bleed through from somewhere.
Well, of course. I think that happens in any case, unless you're actually there and you actually experience it and you can prove without a doubt that that's what's going on. Of course, everyone's going to be skeptical.
Yeah. Well, Paul said earlier, about 5 minutes ago, you were talking to him about opening up and all this to believe. But it's not, I mean, like it says on Paul's thing, don't believe, don't disbelieve, think about it.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not asking him to believe wholeheartedly.
But you know what? That's funny is that things that go on in the ESP field, people that are open to it and either open-minded or accepting of the phenomenon seems to happen more when people have that state of mind and attitude than if people are all just like, this isn't going to happen. I mean, the real actual thing, if something like this is happening, which I think it does occasionally, happens better if there's a receptive audience. It's very strange.
Well, yeah.
No, I mean, not just because you think you're hearing something because you want to. It's because stuff happens that can be verified by other people that weren't there when people are not hostile to the phenomenon. You know what I mean? I don't know if it's so much for ghosts, but it's the same, you know.
I would tend to think that, yeah, if you leave yourself open and you want to believe something, then, yeah, in some cases, maybe you are hearing something just because you want to hear something or see something. Also, I mean, the darkness plays tricks on your eyes. You may actually see something, but it may not be what you think it is.
Yeah, but the trickster nature...
I'm sorry. The trickster nature of the phenomenon you guys are talking about is that lends to the skeptic saying, well, of course it's nonsense because only the true believers are hearing it. See, that's...
I don't think that it's just the true believers actually hear it. I just think that what Greg was saying, if you're more open, if you're more receptive, yeah, then in some cases, yeah, you are going to... I mean, who wants to be?
And I believe it's happening, but I think, unfortunately, I'm one of those who I believe what you're saying, that it is happening because you are more receptive. I'm saying the unfortunate side of that, and where the trickster nature comes in, is that the skeptics are going to say, oh, well, of course you're hearing it. You believe in it. You're never going to convince them.
Fundamentalist skeptics. Yeah, true skepticism I have no problem with.
Somebody that's made their...
True skepticism, Greg has no problem with, but fundamentalist debunkers, as Greg and I debate over who came up with that term first. But
what, fundamentalist skeptics?
No, fundamentalist debunkers. I call them
totally yours.
Oh, okay, thank you. Fundamentalist debunkers. There's nothing wrong with being a debunker if it's bunk.
Exactly.
But so the Phil Classes of the world just say no. It's kind of like the Nancy Reagan of skepticism. Just say no. If you make yourself more open, it's interesting. I consider myself open. I joke about the succubus, but I do want some experience. I'd like to experience something. I'd love to see a UFO. If they really are from Zeta Reticuli, I'd like to meet an alien. Who wouldn't? But until you can, to me, it's like Jodie Foster in Contact, that character in the movie Contact. Yeah. She's skeptical, 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 does the thing, is not skeptical in aliens, skeptical in God. In the whole idea of religion, you can't prove it to me. The Matthew McConaughey character, she goes through her whole experience, meets the aliens, comes back, and can't prove it to anybody. So she basically gets put in the same position as anybody who claims some sort of direct experience with the divine.
Right.
And therein lies the sort of genius of Sagan's work, where he brings science and religion, and says sometimes, you know, there's no difference between the two, frankly, when you're out on a limb. So for me, I just remain a hopeful agnostic. On my Facebook profile, when it says religion, it says hopeful agnostic. I would say the same thing about ghosts or UFOs or any of that stuff. But I'm not sure. This is where I would disagree with Walter and maybe Holly. I'm not sure that you have to be more open to experience it. I think if the ghosts are there or whatever they are, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And right. You know, we sort of like if you see a show, a lot of these ghost hunting shows it's pseudoscience. It really is pseudoscience. At the end of the day, we try and employ the scientific method as much as possible. You're using technical equipment, but.
Yeah, but this thing isn't going to sit there so you can examine it. You can't use a normal scientific method.
I know, but there's not a science of ghost hunting. So in a sense, and I don't mean it in a pejorative way, it's pseudoscience. But a lot of them will get they're almost like the National Academy of Sciences. You must ghost hunt in a certain way. You cannot possibly experiment with a Ouija board. You cannot possibly use psychics because and it's like, well, we intend to. At some point, we'll trot out a Ouija board and see what happens. I've got friends who are who have had very credible people with law degrees and that kind of stuff that you would say these are the most credible people you'll find, and they've had life altering in some cases experiences with Ouija boards. Okay, let's see what happens. Psychics again. I'm a skeptic, but let's bring a psychic in and a reputable one and see what happens with that. So we have all the technical gear that you'll see on Ghost Hunters and other shows, but we're not going to close ourselves off to some of the more esoteric sort of ways of trying to contact whatever might be out there.
thus endeth the lecture.
Yeah, you were talking for so long, I forget what I was going to say. No, it's all very interesting.
No, the thing is that, no, the way the scientific method is practiced, no, you can't do it with ghosts. Or UFOs or anything like that. You can use some of the methods to give yourself a slightly better understanding and convince others who might be think there is nothing to it that maybe, yes, there is something to it. However, the way science is practiced, the physical sciences and all that, maybe there's more, you know, close affiliation with psychology and things like that, some branches of medicine. But the way that it's practiced now, you can't bring something into a lab, do it the same way and repeat it each time. People have tried to do that. Sometimes it works with ESP research. I believe it has. I don't think all those people are lying. People have done the work. But for ghosts and UFOs, Bigfoot thing. Well, actually, that Monster Hunter show, I enjoy it a lot because they're not sensationalistic. And they're trying to get something repeatable and something convincing to people that say there's nothing to it by saying, look, we're all above board here. This is something anybody can examine and come to a conclusion that there's an unexplainable here, at least currently unexplainable.
Well, with the ghost thing, you don't have repeatability in the sense that science would demand it, where if I do X and I give you the template for how to do X, you can repeat X if you have the exact same conditions over and over and over again. But you do have an element of repeatability in the sense if you go to a place like Churchill Mansion and somebody like Holly has a dream and all these other people start having dreams, they're different dreams, and you can't make it happen, but these are similar shared experiences that are repeating themselves. And that isn't scientific repeatability, but it's still some sort of repeatability that's beyond just having something happen as a one-off. And Holly wants the mic here, but I'll say one other thing. There are different, and you know, we've discussed this many times in this show about UFOs, but why worship at the altar of science necessarily? First of all, science is flawed like anything else. Secondly, there are many different ways to prove things, and you know, that's my legal training.
Well, there is. I mean,
you don't go into a court of law and say claim that Joe murdered Francine and say, well, look, let's repeat that. You know, there's no repeatability there. It's witness testimony and then the kind of hopefully sort of hard evidence that we're trying to find, audio data, visual data, whatever.
Yeah. Things that people are used to that convey a message that makes them think about it. Like I said, something everybody can accept. Everybody can accept that people murder people. Everybody can accept that murder weapons are used and certain ways are used to determine who did this. That's not a scientific method. I've argued about this for a long time. There are different ways, like you just said, different ways to prove things And a lot of those include our perceptual and emotional makeup.
Yeah. Holly's the one with the science degree, so Holly can talk about science a bit better than I can. I can just talk about how you prove things in a court of law, how historians prove things using documents, not firsthand testimony, but sometimes you have to come up with a theory, too. You'll have a set of facts. There's the interesting thing. And this applies to ghost hunting and UFOs, for instance. You can have a set of facts about a UFO case, and then you can have seven different people finding seven different interpretations.
Right.
I can give you a set of facts about World War II. You know, today's Pearl Harbor Day. What did Pearl Harbor mean? Did Roosevelt know it was coming? I mean, there is a set of facts. Here's what happened. But did Roosevelt know it was coming? Did he allow it to happen? Or was it a total surprise and a breakdown in intelligence? And historians 60 years later, still 67 years later, still debate that incident, even though the facts that they're all working from are the same. So with ghost hunting or UFOs or anything, here's a set of facts. A witness said they saw this, or five witnesses saw this. And then the interesting question for me is, let's get five people in the room and let's talk about what that means. And that's where that's where it gets less, more amorphous, and then more fun.
Well, and also probably it's something I would like to see that on TV. What's a show like that where people just have sort of a discussion and a debate? Usually those are pretty boring. They don't get high ratings, but I love those shows. You get people who know what they're talking about, maybe on different sides of an issue. Mm-hmm. And have them have a civilized discussion with each other about throwing chairs and calling each other names. And two people who seem to know what they're talking about have proven that they know what they're talking about. And then you're a little bit better able to make up your mind. It's like sitting in a court and listening to two sides of an argument. Who has the better argument?
And
trying to make the best argument possible because somebody's life is hanging in the balance, at least the course of their life.
And I think as the series goes along, you know, and as Holly and I find our feet under us and work on our own dynamic between the two of us, I think you'll see that in future episodes. Perhaps, you know, we discuss a bit more the nature of what we're experiencing, although I think we've already done that a bit in spooky time. But I think that'll come more. And who knows, maybe we'll do a 13th or a 14th episode where we'll just – I know Dale and I have talked about this, the idea of doing a wrap-up episode to each season where, you know, Holly and I sit down and maybe with a couple other people, but we just talk about what we've experienced.
With cuts to the things that you're talking about to keep people interested.
Right, and I'm going to go use the washroom, so Holly will be taking over here for a second.
But well, we can take a break and I'll play some music.
The one thing I would say is the way we structured the episodes.
After Holly speaks.
The way we structured the episodes, by the way, we do have what we call the Bat Cave, which is sort of our HQ of ghost investigation. At the end of every episode, we return to that. Later on, we'll film it after we're done all the episodes.
Right.
And we'll sit there and review the data, and we'll discuss what Holly experienced or I experienced or didn't experience and what that audio thing. And then we'll try and draw some conclusion, which, you know, will probably be, we don't know, but there's something weird here. You make up your own mind and buy the DVD if you want to know more. So, or read our book. Yeah. But we will have that segment at the end where we do have that brief discussion of at least maybe some of this.
Okay. That's a good idea. Oh, okay. Holly is...
We've moved too far away from what I wanted to say, so we'll maybe come back to it later. Who knows?
Well, keep it in mind then.
Bring it back.
Can you remember what it was?
It had something to do with repeatability, I think.
He was asking about the scientific method and possibly what you could bring to it in regards to the ghost show and investigating this phenomena with somebody who actually has a science degree, since mine's in art history.
Well, I don't know if me having a Bachelor of Science in Biology actually means that I'm any more credible than anyone else here, aside from the fact that I'm taking
courses. Well, an understanding
of
that method and how it could be applied or not.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think maybe not so much in the case of UFOs, because that's completely out of my realm, but maybe in the case of a ghost, spirits, that kind of thing, I would say that perhaps there is repeatability there, and that the reason we aren't able to repeat those instances is because there are factors that we can't measure, so we don't know that they're
there. Or control.
Well, there's that too. We're not aware that they're there. We can't repeat them because it's outside of our realm. We're not used to measuring it in that capacity.
Right. Well, there might be an analogy drawn with you have a theory, you observe a phenomenon, but you can't observe the entire phenomenon. You just observe the effects of it, and advance your theory or proof for it based on effects observed without particularly knowing the mechanism by which it manifests itself.
Well, absolutely. We're looking at something that we're not used to looking at, or trying to see something that we're not necessarily meant to see, because it's not always visual.
Right, right. That's why I said perception and emotion and all that enters into this, and those aren't, though, you know, those aren't traditional scientific methods. Your perception of something is one thing. What's going on, and what the phenomenon is, and what can be, the mechanism behind it, should be explainable in a traditional scientific way.
Potentially,
but,
yes.
Yeah, potentially. But you always go back to the idea that people have been using things that work for a long time without knowing how they work, like making bronze or whatever. They didn't know why it worked on a molecular level, but somebody just stumbled onto it and it seemed to work, so they kept using it.
Exactly. So if you're looking at something in the case of Churchill Mansion, where you have Lottie's room where she potentially killed someone, and you have numerous people going into that area and sensing something, whatever that may be, or seeing something in some cases, you might think that you might be able to repeat that somehow. And you probably can, but again, just knowing what exactly those factors are, I don't know them. Oh, Greg's mic's gone out again.
It's gone.
Oh.
Well, not.
Just hit it.
Not on cue or command, anyway. Paul's back.
Go to the song. And
you know what? I think I'll go to the song. Oh, what, Paul?
Greg is segueing now to a song which he's got set up, at which point he's going to try and change mics. Radio Mysterioso will be back with Holly Stevens and Paul Kimball and Greg Bishop
now
and Walter
working.
Right after this musical interlude.
God, he loves to talk.
But nothing else is working, and my heart is really hurting, and I'm
One more.
She's the girl from the fourth dimension. We met once, as I recall. I gave her my close attention when she came walking through my wall. She's the girl from the fourth dimension. One kiss and my toes were curled. Our affair was too brief to mention, for she lived in another world. Other girls have height and width and breadth, but that is all. She had something extra, extra dimensional. No, she's back in the fourth dimension. It's better this way, you see, 'cause I only have three dimensions. She could never be happy with me. She could never be happy with me.
Is that working? This microphone is just horrible. Is that working? Nope. There we go for a little bit. It's Radio Mysterio. So that was Girl from the Fourth Dimension by Sheldon Allman. Before that was Superstition by a band called Blanche, which is they are from L.A., I believe. Don't you know it's bad luck to be superstitious? I love that line.
Anyway, it died again.
Yeah.
Oh, it's out again.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
It's not the, you know what? It's not the microphone. It's the lead going to it. It's the lead.
And now, Paul Kimball singing I'm Blue.
Am I blue? The music of the night. All right, that's all I'm going to sing. Greg's trying a new chord. He's getting things working. We're back with Radio Mysterioso.
Very exciting. Oh, my gosh.
Is that a little better? Is that working? Yeah, that's working a little better.
Great.
Yeah, there we go.
Greg's in his mid-40s. He needs a new chord.
I am not. I mean, I do not.
Walter's going to be here. He's here 7 days a week, twice on Sundays.
It's Radio Mysterioso, falling apart here at the seams.
Try the corned beef, folks. It's great.
And we're talking about the ghost series, Maritime Ghosts, that Paul's working on with our other guest, Holly Stevens. And we can keep talking about the ghost thing. People can also call in 213-215. Oh, no, that's not it. That's my number. 213-252-0998. That's 213-252-0998. You can ask them any questions, discuss things, bring things up, yell wrong, and explain why you think somebody's wrong.
Specifically, we are looking for a new title for our ghost series. We were working with Maritime Ghosts, but if you have something better, please let us know.
Ghosts Ahoy.
I said better.
Boom. And don't forget to try the cannolis. Yeah.
Yeah. Get oot.
Sorry, we're Canadians, so apparently Holly says a boot. Apparently.
Yes.
We were discussing during the break. So, back to ghosts. Or whatever you want to talk about.
Or whatever we want to talk about. I thought that's more interesting to people that are listening, the paranormal angle and all that. Did anything paranormal happen when we were working on Eternal Kiss? I remember there was a strange face in a window somebody took a picture of.
All sorts of paranormal stuff happened. You should see the cost reports. That is definitely Those are definitely paranormal when people are charging you $1.50 for a chocolate bar, let me tell you. That's not normal. No, nothing paranormal happened. Although, oddly enough, the place where we shot the film, the Shelburne Sound Studio in Shelburne, Nova Scotia, is at Government Point, where part of the Shag Harbor UFO incident happened,
yes.
Allegedly. So there was a UFO connection there, which was cool for Greg and I guess.
Yeah, I talked to Mary Barstow, who writes. They write she's basically the writer and editor, and her partner. Jim edits it. However, they had talked to somebody who was there and working for the military during the Shag Harbor incident. And he came. I think he came down just to visit, and he mentioned it to her. And she said, "Would you like to discuss it?" He said, "Nope, not really." And then she said he came back a couple weeks later and did discuss it, as long as she didn't write about it.
Yes,
yeah. Apparently to get it off his chest or something. She said that he got very emotional and started crying while he was talking about it.
Yeah,
and I said, "Why was he crying? I mean, nothing happened to him." And she said, it's probably because, and I agreed with her, it was so far out of the, whatever he experienced was so far out of the range of what he was taught to expect and thought would happen that it freaked him out. People have heard of this. She said that he described these two objects that were in the water off the point there where we were for a month. And there was one first, and then another one came up while they were watching it underwater and joined the other one. And then they moved off after like a day or two off under the water, and they didn't see them come out of the water again. But apparently they had divers down there and boats out there looking at it and everything. So maybe Uncle Don Ledger would have a little bit more details on the Shag Harbor incident. But it is probably the most well-known Canadian UFO sighting, at least outside of Canada. Or incident. Well, it was a sighting. People saw things shoot and fall into the water.
Residents, I believe RCMP officers, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, military personnel. I would say the best investigated UFO case in Canadian history is the Stephen Mischalek incident from 1967 in Falcon Lake.
Was that
Manitoba.
Don't touch the hull, pal? It's hot.
Yeah. And
I love that line.
That was extensively investigated by the Canadian military. The United States military got involved, the Condon Committee, a number of Canadian government departments, as well as many exchanges in the House of Commons by members of Parliament, specifically one guy, Ed Schreier, who went on to become our Governor General and Premier of Manitoba, who they were asking serious questions about what happened to this guy who was in their
Why don't you describe, people like UFO porno, so why don't you describe what the incident was? Please. Well, you can also refresh my memory. All I know is he was a geologist and he was out, right?
Yeah, he was an amateur geologist. And he
out there by himself.
Yeah, he was out looking, prospecting or whatever you would call
it.
In Manitoba, in southern Manitoba, a place called Falcon Lake, I believe.
That's right.
Not too far from Winnipeg, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
And
he'd taken the bus out there.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure about that.
And hiked.
He saw a round spherical.
What year was this? I'm sorry.
1967.
Okay.
Saw a round spherical object, and then he approached it. A door opened. I guess he reached in, which I mean I wouldn't do, but he did, and experienced some sort of. And I'm not doing it justice. Some sort of heat, some sort of kind of almost attack or something coming out at him.
I thought it was some kind of a vent that shot hot air out and hit him in the chest.
Yeah, that could be because he had a waffle-like pattern on his chest.
Oh, he was faking it. He just put a waffle iron on his chest.
Where it left a burn on him. And that was basically it. I mean, you can go on.
Yeah, online there's pictures of him.
Mischalek, Mischalek. You can Google that and UFO in the same sentence, and you'll find out all you need to know about the case. But it was a very heavily investigated case. It relies in large part on the credibility of Mischalek himself. But there's also physical evidence, too. I mean, he had those burn marks on his chest. So unless he did it himself, something happened to him. And it was listed, I believe, in the Condon report as being unexplained. So it was one of the cases that even the Condon report, and I'm willing to be corrected if I'm wrong there, but I'm pretty sure they listed it as unexplained.
I think
the Canadian government definitely listed it as unexplained. They could not explain what happened to him, other than he was hoaxing it. That's sort of some people offered that explanation.
Did he not hear a voice come from inside saying, don't touch the hull, pal, it's still hot?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether he heard a voice or whether it was some sort of telepathic thing. I mean, yeah. It didn't make my film the top 10 cases. But
I just like that line.
If we'd had a top 20, it would have been voted in. I think it was the 14th best or whatever.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, you know, the people I polled, the UFO experts, definitely considered it a major case of major significance.
Right.
In Canadian history, that one's probably the best investigated one. Shag Harbor is probably the best known one. And it happened in the same year. Both happened in 67.
Yeah.
Shag's better known simply because people have tagged it as Canada's Roswell.
Yeah.
And as soon as you put Roswell after something with, you know, crashed flying saucers or whatever, that tends to resonate a bit more than a case like the Mishalik case, where there's no cover-up. There's just a guy with a good sighting and an experience that you can't explain. And that's not quite as sexy maybe today.
Yeah, well, although, New Mexico's Roswell is Socorro.
Yeah. No, New Mexico's Mishalik case is Socorro.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, the Lonnie Zamora case. So,
no, I think New Mexico's Roswell is Socorro, actually.
I think New Mexico's Roswell is Aztec.
That's even worse.
Yeah, no, I know.
That's an even worse analogy.
It's funny, I did a film on Aztec 6 years ago, and at the time of the film, you can buy it, you can see the film, and there's Scott Ramsey saying, we've got these samples from these core samples from this block of cement or whatever, rebar, we're testing it now, we'll have results, you know, by December. And 6 years
Nothing.
Later, still goes to conferences, we're testing it, we'll have results by, you know, the next conference I do.
You know what I'm wondering about? I have a picture that I just found the other day that I'd lost for a long time of a piece of metallic debris that I took in 2001 at my friend Mario Pozzaglini's house, the alien writing guy who passed away in 1999. What he said this was somebody gave this to him, and I don't know the background on it. I'll show you the picture. I mean, it just, you know, doesn't look like anything. It looks like it's a very shiny, polished-looking piece of metal, but the metal looks like it's been twisted, heated, and wrenched apart. I don't know. I guess there's some sorts of metal that do that. However, his life partner, whatever the guy, what's his name, Joey or John or something like that, still takes care of all of his stuff. And apparently he'd given a piece of – he has since given this piece to Linda Moulton Howe, and I haven't heard anything about it. But he said this piece was from somebody gave it to him saying this is a piece from a flying saucer crash. And he kept it in a lead-lined bag because he said that he had tested it and did have some radioactivity in it. Very low level, but, you know, if it's sitting there in a bag the whole time, you know, why not just shield it so it doesn't sit there and irradiate wherever you're living? And I didn't know what to do. I picked it up. I held it. It was very heavy. And I'd like to ask Linda Howe whatever happened to that piece of metal. And you know what Mario did tell me, and he didn't lie to me. He's just a very honest guy. He said, I took a piece of this. I had two or three pieces. He said, I gave one piece to University of Delaware. He lived in Delaware. And asked them to analyze it for me. I was going to pay for it and everything. He was on the faculty of the University of Maryland, so I guess they gave him some deal. However, he said, after a couple of months, he said, where's that metal I gave you there? What metal? It just disappeared. So I don't know what happened to that case. I don't know what's going on with it. I don't know where the metal came. That's something that I'd like to follow up on. It just reminded me now when you said about the Ramsey dealing with the pieces of metal from Aztec, which I went there once, and I got chased out of there by people in trucks, which was very strange.
Well, yeah, the difference, though, between those two stories is nobody's claiming that the stuff they took from Aztec has disappeared. In fact, even if it had disappeared, you could go back, and the cement block is still there.
Yes, I saw it. Yeah.
So the question is, how long does it take you to conduct scientific tests, especially when you sort of it's like post-millennial evangelicals. You keep promising a date when Jesus is going to return.
Yeah, yeah.
When the date doesn't come, you lose some of your supporters, but there's always going to be that core group of idiots.
Right.
True believers who are going to stick with you no matter how many times you put a carrot in front of their face
and then jerk it away. Lucy with the football.
Sure, right after you've gotten
you fall flat on your ass.
And you jerk it away right after you've gotten a free trip to a UFO conference to speak about this impending great disclosure.
Right, right.
So I've gone off on a slight tangent about people in the UFO
world. Okay.
That annoy me.
Politics in the United States.
Yeah.
We just went through that. It's like
all politics, actually.
Well, especially in Canada. But that's a long story.
No, anytime you want to say something, Walter, it's fine. Just say, we've only got two microphones.
I
can hog this because it's my show.
Me too. You know what we should do, though? We should hand the mics over to Walter and Holly.
Okay.
And they can talk about ghosts. And then we'll bring it back to ghosts away from you. We've talked about UFOs before.
That's okay. It's an endlessly fascinating subject, and I'm not ready to drop it. However, I think it's a good suggestion. Here you go, Walter.
Here you go, Holly.
Hello, Holly.
Hello, Walter.
they've jumped off track on this. So, what's the best ghost experience you've ever had?
Define ghost.
Any spirits of the dead, that kind of thing.
I haven't actually visually seen anything, not sort of like manifestation of a person who may have lived before. Really, it's all just been feelings.
Okay, so you're an intuitive then, you would say.
I hope so.
Okay, receptive, intuitive.
I try to be. Wow, I got really loud.
Usually it's Paul and Dawson. Paul's funny.
Not.
Yeah. No. It just comes back to what you want to call it, the sixth sense. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. I don't know if I have that. But
well, I'm an intuitive too, so I know what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Well,
I pick things up and I can sense when something is there. Sometimes it creeps me out.
Yeah, I'm sure sometimes it's some sort of manifestation of my own emotional state or imagination. The other times, maybe not. And I think sometimes you have to separate it, but I'm not quite sure how to always do that. How do you do that?
I have... It rarely gets to me in a creepy way. I got to tell you, I've been working on a project that I have been encountering... all sorts of phenomena just about every night for the last several months. I get rappings on the outside wall of the house. I write in a particular room.
This is all in one location?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This same house, it's been in our family, just my sister and her husband, it was their first house. And so it's been in our family for about 20-some years. And my mom's husband died there. In fact, he died in the room I write in, because I'm in the house now, and but he's still there too. But I've sensed when he's around, I smell his pipe. It distinctly smells like somebody's smoking in the room he's in, and the house does not smell like that all the time. And this happens when neither the heater or the air conditioning's on. Because a lot of times if you've had a smoker in the house, it gets in the vents, you got the air blowing, you're going to get the residue.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and that's not a ghost, that's just residue. But there is phenomena outside the house that I encounter, things rushing up on me, rappings on the outside.
Now you say things rushing up on you, like you see something, or is it just kind of a...
I haven't seen it, feel it.
You feel this force just come up, and it's right there in front of you.
Well, usually behind me, because I generally am somebody who's reluctant to see. I don't want to see because I'm concerned that it's not something like I'd like to see.
I would.
But
agree.
It has been so strong some nights that I can't get into the house fast enough. Now that was a few years ago when I didn't understand some things that was going on, that, like I do now or think I do now. And it doesn't scare me as much. But occasionally, there's something. It got so bad one night that I actually went to a motel because I could not stay in the house. Now, I'm, 6'1", not a small guy. I've, been in a job where I go to dangerous places, this, that, and the other. And I was so damn spooked that I went and got a motel room one night.
Now, do you think that this force, this energy... coming towards you, do you think that is the spirit of someone?
Yeah. I want to say that I know it is. Yeah, absolutely. I've been confused as to exactly who it was, and I recently had a woman stop me in a bookstore and flat out tell me that she sees my grandmother, a grandmother who died before I was born, standing right beside me. And wow. I'm thinking, okay, she must do this for a living. When is the pitch to come on out and get a reading going to happen? And she said she does not do it for a living. We exchanged numbers. I called her once, and she's never returned my call, which tells me I have a very good friend who's very strong with her psychic abilities, and she's extremely reluctant to do it. She'll do it for me, but she's extreme. I sometimes have to, it's like pulling teeth. So to me, that's kind of bona fides, because the real ones don't take money for it.
Mm-hmm.
I've found I'm really hard on psychics. I think, unfortunately, I think most of them have either diluted whatever true ability they had by taking money, or they're, you know, bullshit artists. Out to make money.
I don't necessarily think that there's anything wrong with taking money if you have a talent like that, but I think some people who may have an innate ability trained ability take advantage, and they kind of blow it out of proportion sometimes, I think, which is unfortunate for all those other people who are really just trying to understand.
Well, I think the ones who take money, unfortunately, the tendency is to get focused more on making the money, so therefore the focus is not on their abilities, and some of it is perishable in some ways, or it's like they get out of practice, so they're not as strong. But yeah, she told me that it was this grandmother who, again, you know, and what was really weird was that this is a perfect stranger. And she told me something about my grandmother that she couldn't possibly have known. And
such as?
She said, first she described her physically. She said she's a small woman with dark hair, almost black. I'm like, yeah, because I've seen the pictures. I heard the description of her. And then a little bit later in the conversation, she said, you know, she was really fond of roses, wasn't she? Which is true. And that for me was the most convincing.
So this person... She was able to see your grandmother? She was with you?
Oh, well, we were in the bookstore, and she, perfect stranger, she goes, oh, excuse me, but I don't want you to think I'm crazy, but, and then she went into it. She got the name right. She said, were you close to, do you know somebody, you know, related to someone named Marion or Mary, which her name was Mary? That got my attention. Like, yeah. Okay. And so she got the name right, she got the physical description, and then she got the thing with the roses. And she told me she's been attached to you for years. And if whenever you feel a female presence, it's her.
Nah.
And that's exactly what I have felt. When I was in Ohio at Wright Pat, there was a presence in my apartment there that would walk up right behind me and watch what I was doing on the computer. I felt it, and I felt it very strongly. And I suspected it was female. But I wasn't sure. And then the presence rushing up on me at the house out here has always been female.
And you think, is it both your grandmother, do you think?
Well, of course, it might be, because I thought I had been taught how to do necromancy to raise the dead. I know a system. He used this thing that I've been wearing for 21 years. I'll tell you about it later. I've been taught a method of necromancy, how to raise the dead from old cemeteries and stuff.
Interesting.
And I first tried it, and I should say last tried it, in a colonial era cemetery on Long Island in Northport, for those New York listeners. And I thought maybe that I had brought her up, but because it was a female, and maybe didn't put her down, and she had attached herself to me, is what I thought. So, but it was never malevolent. It just freaked me out. But I have sensed a variety of spirits. What freaked me out that night was I felt something that really scared the hell out of me, that I felt was just really bad, and I felt it was looking at me through the window.
Like literally through a window.
Yeah, there was one room where the TV is, and I, it got to me. I felt its presence looking at me through the window.
Was this before or after your
the
raising of the dead?
Oh, this was years after. I did that in the cemetery on Long Island back in the early 90s when I was living back there, and this was just in the last. This happened, I would say, probably 2004. Is when this happened. And since then, you know, but that's, you know, we've talked about it on here, some of the the wacky shit I've been experiencing. But I'm somebody, though, that I'm actually a lot more like Paul in many ways, where, you know, I think there's a lot of bullshit out there, and I like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have experienced stuff myself. I've been going through, for the last year and a half, experiencing a lot of weird things, but I don't like to lie or exaggerate about it. I'll say what it was, you know, and then that's, anyway.
It's interesting, this is Paul back here, here's a Radio Mysterioso exclusive. And are you going to do a musical break, by the way? You've got something queued up.
It's not appropriate of anything, apropos of anything we're doing here. I found a record today at Amoeba. It's a soundtrack from an old German TV, sci-fi TV show. And I can't remember. It's called Orion 5 or something like that. And it's basically German space lounge music from a TV show from the mid-1960s.
Perfect. So are you queued up with it?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to throw to the music here, folks, on Radio Mysterioso. And when we return...
Paul's taking over the show here.
Yeah, that's right. I've taken over the show. I'm directing.
Go ahead.
When we return, I will recount for the first time ever in public my own paranormal experience. Dun, 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 dun. Stay tuned. Walter, Greg, Holly, and Paul will be right back.
Thank you, Paul. So it frees me up for doing this kind of stuff.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Is that working? That's it was the intro from a show called Orion 7 or Space Patrol. Although the album is, for some reason, is called Rampatrui.
Something Patrol.
Oh, yeah, probably Space Patrol.
Rampatrol.
Rampatrol. It's German. It's Rampatrol. You could probably find it on YouTube. There's bits and pieces of it. I've seen it. Before we went to break here, Paul Kimball, director of Eternal Kiss and Best Evidence, among other things, besides Stanton Friedman is Real, Fields of Fear, and Do You Believe in Magic? What was the Aztec one called?
Aztec 1948, as well as two seasons of a classical music series for Bravo called The Classical Now.
Was going to tell us about his only paranormal experience, an experience which he could not explain, apparently.
Well, not my only one, although it's the only one I
the
can
best
remember.
One.
It's interesting too. My co-producer and co-director on the Ghost series, Dale Stevens, is very interested in residual hauntings, battlefield ghosts, the idea that some sort of psychic, spiritual, ghostly energy could be left in, say, a rifle or a helmet or some artifact. And so that's something I'm just mentioning apropos of nothing that we may also explore. These are the whole range of things that we're looking at on the show. But in terms of my own experience, I've always been fascinated. If you believe in reincarnation, if you're convinced in reincarnation, which I'm not, but I'm, again, a hopeful agnostic, this idea that you're sort of in tuneness, if you will, with the other world is stronger when you're a child. As you grow older, and I've talked to a number of people I consider reasonably reputable psychics, but leaving aside psychics, people who are just, I definitely consider reputable when it comes to things like this. These are good, solid people, will tell you that it's their opinion that as you grow older, you grow more into this life and you leave whatever previous life you might have had behind. Fine.
Uh-huh.
When I was young, when I was a kid, somewhere between the ages of, I'd say, 6 and 9, I couldn't pinpoint it now all these years later, but I would be lying on a couch. It would almost always be on a couch. I remember one in particular but this would happen a number of times where I'd be reading usually, but who knows, I could just be lying there. And literally, all of a sudden, it would feel as if I was falling. Where I have this very real memory of almost the wind rushing by me, my stomach, sort of that thing where you're on a giant roller coaster and you get your stomach is still at the top of the roller coaster, even though you're now at the bottom kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that idea, if I ever fell off a very large cliff, I'm pretty much convinced that's what it would have felt like. And it would, you know, didn't happen every day. It was relatively rare, but it would come. I have no possible explanation for it. There's no rational reason I can think of as to why I would feel that way. So anywho, I never, you know, eventually it stopped happening. I didn't think anything of it. And then once I started doing these paranormal related films, I had occasion to talk to a spiritualist, an investigator of the paranormal who I considered reputable up in Nova Scotia. And I asked him about it. And he said, look, you know, how old were you? And I said, well, somewhere between 6 and 9. I can't really remember. And then he explained to me that, in his opinion, that would have been the echo of a past life, that in some previous life, I would have died in that, or that would, I assume if I was falling, I probably died. But that sensation would have happened to me. It's a representation of something traumatic that would have happened, that an echo that remained with me into this life. And then eventually, as you grow older, you grow into this life, and those echoes diminish and eventually vanish, which is why I know at least one person, maybe two, that have had a number of paranormal experiences when they were younger, and eventually they're very intuitive, and eventually that left them as they grew older into this life. So anyway, that kind of stuff has always fascinated me. That angle to it has fascinated me, and that, for what it's worth, you know, I relate to you in a sense, Walter, where I'm absolutely an agnostic, a skeptic, sometimes a debunker. But even myself, even the debunkers, the skeptics, whatever, I have an experience that I can still remember to this day that I can't explain when I was younger. And I'm sure some psychologist somewhere would have an explanation for it. I just don't know what it is. But I do know what other people that I consider fairly credible have told me from their perspective, from their outlook on the way the world works and the way, you know, past lives work, if you believe in that. Their explanation is that was an echo from a previous life. So there, hopefully that was worth it for all those people that wanted to hear my paranormal experience. But, you know, I had one too.
It's funny you say that about kids growing up, losing that. When I interviewed Joe McMonagle, I don't know if I actually put this in the book. I think I did. He had a twin sister, Joe McMonagle being remote viewer number 001 for the Army's remote viewing program when it was called, what was the first name of it?
What?
Grill Flame, yes, in the late 70s. He said he had a twin sister, and she had the same experience as he had, knowing when things were going to happen, knowing when something was happening away from them, you know, like if their parents were in trouble or somebody was coming home or whatever. They both had these, and for some reason, the attention of their parents and everybody focused on her to tell her to stop doing it. Oh, no, you're not seeing that. That's, you know, that's not something that happens. And he said that she lost it. But he said his parents and the people around him, and he saw that and he started shutting up about it, although still experiencing it. And he's apparently, as his claim is and has been apparently substantiated by other people who've worked with him, he kept it. So there's a, you know, growing older, but there was an entrainment going on with, his sister apparently just to stop it, and that made it go away too. He said that when she stopped believing that it was happening and all that, it just stopped. It closed that channel for her.
It's interesting when you're born, when you think about it, you're like tabula rasa. Everything is open to you. Your life could go in a zillion different directions. And then slowly but surely, it's like John Lennon's song, Working Class Hero, various forces start putting you in a box. They start closing doors, and usually for pretty good reasons. I mean, it's just you have to fit into society. But sometimes you start losing things. That sense of magic, this reminds me of Pan's Labyrinth, where, you know, was it real or was it not real? Well, it depends on your perspective. If you're an adult watching that,
right,
your point of view might be that, no, it was all in her head. And if you still have that sense of wonder, even about movies, you would look at a film like Pan's Labyrinth and say, maybe she really did, if you're familiar with the film, right, maybe she really did experience all those things and there's a different ending, which is why it was such a good film. It mirrored our own way of looking at the world. And saying it's closed-minded isn't right. That's a pejorative way of looking at it. But saying if you're rooted in the here and now, in the very real world that you can touch, the tangible world, the box that people put everybody in, and there's a lot of room within that box to do different things, but if you're rooted there, you see it one way. If you've somehow managed to leave a door or two open, or you sort of find a way to get out of the box, then an awful lot of other things might open up for you. And here's the crazy thing. I think science, at least elements of science, are finally coming around to opening the box again. Guys like Michio Kaku and other people who are talking about, and Jacques Vallée was doing this a long time ago,
yeah,
but it's now permeating
Dean Radin's doing it now, Robert John, the people with the SSE.
And it's now moving into being accepted as more mainstream scientific thought.
Well, sort of.
Well, when you talk about a guy like
more
Kaku,
mainstream scientists are becoming heretics and looking into it in a serious way to see if there's something to it.
But it's heretical to the established scientific order, which really arose after the Second World War, when the scientific establishment, particularly in the United States, became enmeshed with the military-industrial complex. I'm no conspiracist. That's just a historical fact.
Right, right.
And so everything gets channeled off, most of it, into military applications, a very rigid way of looking at practical applications. And somebody was writing on a blog the other day, you know, where's the next Einstein? Like, why haven't we had a true Einstein in the last 60 or 70 years?
We have, but we don't understand them yet.
Or, you know, we had, but they wound up working for General Electric, building a better toaster. So I think science is finally coming around. I think the world in general may finally be coming around to rediscovering a sense of magic. And hopefully, with our ghost hunting show or my UFO films or whatever, I'll rediscover that sense of magic personally. So in the film and television biz, we like to talk about journeys that people take. But I think, and Holly can speak to her own experience, but for me, the 13 episodes of season one, you know, a journey. Like I said, at the end, hopefully I will have opened one of those doors that somebody closed for me a long time ago. Maybe I closed for myself. And then I'm keen to see what's behind that door.
I think you're absolutely right there, Paul. It's a matter of, yeah, I know, I agreed with you. I think, I believe that it's a matter of the intuition that people have, the gut feelings that they have on everyday basis. It's that they don't always recognize. They're not consciously aware of why they do things, and it's a matter of bringing that into the conscious mind so that you think about it and you realize that you're thinking about it.
I'm waiting. No, go ahead.
Oh,
okay. On the issue of where are the geniuses since Einstein, there's an interesting coincidence that I think has everything to do with this, and that is what you're talking about, the U.S. military-industrial complex. That rose out of World War II. Well, a lot of things have been locked down and in secret, and I think the genius is there. We just don't know who he is, which leads me to the gentleman, the legendary gentleman who a few of us are very much interested in. A man, are you familiar with Wilson? Have you ever heard of Wilson?
Yet, comrade.
Wilson is quite an interesting figure. He's this enigmatic figure. He is allegedly the Einstein and times 10, or at least, you know, times 2. And he is the allegedly this man who is this brilliant mind who is behind a lot of the very what when you're talking about the UFO secrecy and such, and a lot of related phenomenon. He is allegedly the man who is right there in it. I learned about him first through my own father, and then my professional mentor, and other people I know who are interested in Wilson. They've learned about him, and these are scientists or science writers, and they've heard about him in their channels. And we believe that he was even written about in the book Genesis by W.H. Harbinson. But anyway, Wilson. You might find it interesting to get into the Wilson search.
This is a personage that goes in and out of various unreported histories of technology basically in the United States through most of the 20th century and part of the 19th, the late 19th.
It's believed his grandfather and father were part of the group of Wilsons that were involved with the 1896, the airship mystery of the 1800s.
I think that there's been, I've got actually three books on the airship mystery at home, and they range from it was airships to it was, one of them says it was airships, plain and simple. Another says it was all hoaxes, and another is kind of a mixture of the two. Actually, I still have one of those books that you lent me. I have to give it back. Yeah, 1897 airship mystery. Solved, yeah.
It's funny. And,
I forgot what I was going to say after that, so go ahead.
More or less apropos of nothing, but slightly related. I remember talking to my friend, the late Carl Flock, once, and in an unguarded moment, Carl said, whatever you're holding in your hand right now, iPod, he didn't say iPod, but whatever it might be that you have, we had it 10 years ago. You know, in his case, CIA.
Well, that's the government. Yeah, you know, unguarded moment. I think that's taken for granted among most people that are the Jane's Defense Weekly people that watch military hardware and cutting-edge science stuff 10, 15, 20 years from now, will have things they're using at this moment.
Sure. And,
Walter can attest to this because he was tasked with keeping these secrets for quite a few years.
I was involved on a program level, yeah. I mean, I've seen it in the U.S. Air Force anyway. It's absolutely true. Is there a particular one you like? Well, what does...
And something that has Death Ray in it. That would be cool, too.
Well, now...
I like that story about Iraq. The people you talk to in Iraq going in, and something goes in before they get there.
Oh, yeah.
And then they pull back, and then the regular forces come in.
When I was an agent here at Los Angeles Air Force Base, this would have been 94 to 96, but it was around 94, 95... My supervisor, she had been the top program protection agent, and for the OSI, Air Force OSI. And,
okay, sorry.
Now you got to understand, I still have to be careful about how I talk about this stuff.
Yes.
And hilarious as this may seem, foreign nationals. So I have to. I know that sounds goofy, but I know. Oh, hey, you know, I know, but I. We can go to jail for saying the wrong thing to somebody in MI6 who, you know, the U.S. Anyway.
Paul says he can't trust the British.
But what I...
Tune out, Nick Pope.
Definitely what I heard was that there's something that goes in ahead of the F-117s that scares the hell. It gets the attention of the enemy. Scares the hell out of them.
In what way, though?
It's
you could set off, you could project things on clouds, set off
small,
bombs.
Okay. It's small. It is it makes its presence known with great emphasis. And I know that sounds vague, but here's the interesting thing.
Wakes everybody up and freaks them out.
You know, back when I was learning this, this was something. You know, there wasn't a.
And this
hole.
Is at night.
Yeah. You know, the F-117. You know, the stealth fighter still had some mystery about it back in the early, you know, 90s. Even though they'd been flying them since the late 70s.
Right.
Yeah.
Or prototypes since the late 70s.
You know, there was even a TV show where they were talking to one of the commanders of one of the first squadrons. And he says on this TV documentary that there he was, you know, like a major or something back then, or a captain. And they said, hey, what do you think of this? And they showed him an illustration of it. And he said, that'll be great. That'll be really cool. When are we going to, you know, have that about 50 years from now? And they asked him, you want to fly one now? And apparently it was, you know, now that matches some of the weird shit people saw flying out in the desert, you know.
Right, right.
By description.
At night, but supposedly they weren't testing these things in the daytime till after they'd announced it.
Right. And there's a physical reason for that.
And I just have to say, as a Canadian citizen, that given the amount of technology the United States has stolen and purloined from my country over the years, starting with the Avro Aero, where we were building planes that could fly rings around whatever you have now, much less back in the 1950s, I take umbrage at somebody telling me that we're not trustworthy allies that can't be included.
Talk to my masters. I sign the paper, I see the cool shit, my eyes get big, and that's the price I pay. Pissing off all my friends.
Well, I talk to your masters on a regular basis. They're Canadians, of course. I mean, just look, we've sent you William Shatner, Celine Dion, Leslie Nielsen, Brian Adams. I mean, you know, Paul Schaefer. Yeah, that's true. And actually, weirdly enough, we were walking down the Hollywood Boulevard today, the Hollywood Walk of Fame, saw Leslie Nielsen star, the guy from the Naked Gun films.
From Forbidden Planet. That's
Forbidden
right.
Planet, yes.
Very, very little known fact, Leslie Nielsen's brother, Eric Nielsen, was once the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada.
It's a very accomplished family.
Not quite like being the Vice President, but sort of the same thing. And here's another weird one. Norm Macdonald, the comedian from Saturday Night Live, his brother was the primary political reporter for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So you've got these weird, crazy actor Canadians, and then you've got Sirius brother. He's the one who made Good. And then the crazy ones go to the U.S.
Kind of like you and your brother.
So we keep the smart ones. We send the crazy ones. Yeah, that's right. So I'm coming down here. Woo-hoo! And Jim's going to stay up in Canada and be serious and become prime minister.
Yes.
So.
Of course. That leads into nothing.
Hey, well, we were playing around with flying saucers in the 50s. The whole, what was it, Project Silverbug or whatever the heck that thing is.
That was one of them.
Nick Redfern would know better than I. It's in his book. And
how many of his books?
Yeah, I don't know, like the 28th book that Nick's written. Nick Redfern.
Idea Machine.
Next to ubiquitous in the dictionary, there's a picture of Nick. ubiquitous author.
Looking at you very seriously.
Yeah.
Over his shoulder.
Look, there's one of the things I agree with Stan Freeman on. This guy, he held a Q clearance for years, worked in industry. Never, Stan makes a point of saying, other than delivering mail, he wasn't a mailman. He worked briefly delivering something. He didn't work for the U.S. government. He wasn't he worked for GM and Westinghouse and all these private corporations, but he held a top secret clearance working on very secret things, fusion rockets and stuff back in the 60s.
Right.
That, you know, who knows where, as he says, who knows where that project went when they officially closed it down?
Well, one of them was Cash Landrum.
Yeah. Well, who knows? It's quite possible.
Radiation thing flying, jet flying. One jet of them, flying out of the bottom, sticking out of the bottom of a diamond-shaped object out in the middle of nowhere in Texas.
One of them, see, apropos of nothing, one of them might have been, I bring it all back, Stephen Mishalik.
Could be, yeah.
There you go. Look at that. It was a circuitous journey, folks, but we're back to Stephen Mishalik. So, there you go.
Nick could, yes. I think he could be Lex Luthor.
Or Mac Tonies could be Lex Luthor now.
That's true.
A young Lex Luthor. Nick's a slightly older, punkier Lex Luthor.
Right, right.
If Lex Luthor was a Ramones fan, that would be Nick Redfern. If Lex Luthor is an REM fan, that's Mac Tonies.
Right.
And if Lex Luthor still has a little bit of hair left, that's me. So those are the three candidates.
Yeah, I don't get the $10 special like Paul does. The
Bald is Beautiful special.
Yeah. I don't get that yet. So either they're very mercenary here or I still actually have a little bit of hair.
Thanks for bringing that up, Greg, like bad Chinese food.
oh, shut up, Walter. Jesus.
Holly and Walter are now showing us their hair. So
they're waving their hair at us.
Waving their hair at us. The next sound you're going to hear is us flushing this show down the toilet because...
That's okay. There's only 6 minutes left of it.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah, we cannot look at what we're reading on the internet and start talking about it. That just kills the show. What's next for Paul and Holly?
I was just going to say, is this our shameless plug section?
Yes.
Yay. Coming up next, the Ghost Hunting Series, watch for it in Canada on Eastlink.
Working title, Maritime Ghosts.
Call it Maritime Ghosts. It might be Ghost Files or some other title. We're not quite
are there
sure.
Is there any way that people on this side of the warmer climes can actually see this at some point soon?
We have Breakthrough Entertainment out of Toronto is going to be distributing it internationally, so hopefully it will sell into the United States. Any network would be foolish to not air a program that had Holly Stevens in it, even if it has me in it. So you get a little bit of the
sugar. She counteracts you and brings it up even a little bit.
You get the sugar and the spice, both of which are Holly, and then you get sort of like bland mustard, and that's kind of like me.
Horseradishy mustard.
Horseradishy mustard.
Why don't you tell people, Paul, what makes this show different from other ghosts?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Instead of just talking about what sugar you've been and saying, spice and dry mustard or something.
What you've been saying makes it sound like, hey, this is going in a direction that I think these kind of shows should go, where you not only treat it seriously, but you also discuss, like you said, something that hasn't been discussed before. Everybody's like, there's a ghost. There's not a ghost. I'm scared. I'm, did you hear that voice? No. Where does it come from? What is it connected to? How does it affect us? How does it advance science, maybe, or at least our knowledge of things?
Well, from a directing point of view, In my case, like all the films that I do dealing with the paranormal, it comes from a sugar and spicy perspective of hopeful agnosticism. All I want to do is, you can eat two types of food, bland, which is what I usually eat, or spicy. Now, but in the paranormal world, I want spicy. And for many years now, all I've had is bland.
Habanero ghosts.
Exactly. So I'm going out there and I'm looking for Kung Pao chicken paranormal experiences. I want something that will settle my stomach. The spicy chicken ghosts and goblins in my
brings
stomach
brings it all back up.
Exactly. We'll start rumbling and I'll feel something. So all I want to do with the series is feel something. What makes it different from other ghost shows is I don't watch those shows. So I have
Paul actually went and bought a DVD of some ghost hunting shows so he could see, as I said, not to make the same mistakes.
Yeah. No, I don't want to do what other people are doing. The same thing is true with the UFO films I made. I didn't want to do what other people were doing. So what I did was I looked at a guy like Errol Morris and said, how does Errol Morris make his documentaries? Because I wanted to be a documentary maker first who did documentaries about a wide range of subjects. I've done pro wrestling, classical music, the blues, a bunch of stuff. So take that and just apply that to the paranormal. And I think that's when we pitched it to Eastlink. That's exactly what I told him. I said, look, we're not going to make some...
Your co-producer has the same idea, actually. Yes. I talked to him for about 20 minutes about this.
Dale, yeah. Dale. We're not just going to make some slash and dash ghost hunter knockoff. What we want to do is an actual documentary series. Then, as it wound along, we with Holly and I think it's also partly about us. And I hate to use the word again, but journey. And this idea that...
I don't have any journey on my iPod, sorry.
Where are Holly and I going to wind up after 13 episodes... of experiencing hopefully something, what is our perspective going to be on it? And for those people that know me in the paranormal community, it might be interesting to watch me try and become take my skepticism and see if I can experience something. And for those people that haven't gotten to know Holly yet, what I think you'll see, and Holly can talk about her own experiences, but what I think you'll see with Holly is somebody who's a lot brighter than the average person you're going to see on these ghost hunting shows, who has a sense of intuition, of willingness to explore, to be adventurous. And, this is a good thing, too. Also knows how to be in front of a camera. I'm sorry, but you're dealing with two folks here who know how a camera works. So you're going to get a slick show, but not a slick show, if you know what I mean. It's going to look good, but it's not scripted. Holly and I really do hate each other. I will play practical jokes. We'll have fun. But at the end of the day, there is a serious undercurrent in it. And it's not going to be one of these shows where you're going to have somebody going, I'm so scared.
I'm so
unless
startled, yeah.
They're really that frackin' scared.
Oh, that's something I wanted to ask you. People are like, you think of people going, oh, my God. It's like on Casper the Friendly Ghost or Scooby-Doo or whatever. What I get from people, I've never really seen any ghostly things or experience except maybe a smell, and that didn't make me jump. But what they're scared of is not a ghost. They're scared of being startled.
Poppy-ody things, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
And it comes back to, yeah.
I'm so startled.
I'm not necessarily afraid of experiencing the supernatural. I'm sometimes afraid of how I would react to it, because I think in those cases, it's kind of how people get injured. But yeah, I'm concerned sometimes of what I might see.
Yeah. We had Richard Sennett, who's a renowned ghost hunter person from Southern California. He lives up in Ventura County. I asked him, I asked him the same question. I was like, usually you think people going, a ghost! Ah! I said, from what you described to me, because he was describing his own experiences and experiences of film crews he's been on, etc. I said, it sounds more like a shocked awe, shock and awe, a startled awe. I don't want to say shock and awe. A startled awe, like, just, it's kind of there, and you think it's some normal thing for about half a second, then you realize it isn't. You're just kind of in this weird mind space for a while, even after it's gone away, because you're saying, what the hell did I just see? Or what the hell did I just experience? And I've never really seen that on a show. It's kind of more like, what was that? Oh, God. And fast cuts and people's words being flashed on the screen. This sounds like it's delving more into that, how do people actually feel?
Well, sure. There's two things. One, in spooky time, you may actually see Holly and I get freaked out. There was something that happened in real time in the Five Fishermen restaurant where we basically said, because we're still in contact with the crew down on another floor, get the camera up here, the HD camera up here now. We need to film this. Did you guys hear that? It was an audio thing. And my sound guy could hear, he absolutely heard it through his headphones. So that happened then. And I got to admit, I was a bit freaked out by that. Not freaked out, but I was interested. I was adrenalized. But
you had a startled awe.
Exactly. Definitely startled. In our show, however, the sort of startled part might come at the end of the show when we're back in HQ just listening to what happened over 9 hours of audio.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
when you're not there anymore, but you get startled by hearing mommy or ah or whatever we hear on these audio recordings
yeah.
that you maybe didn't hear when you were there. So it could go either way.
Yeah, it's a whole nother area we didn't get into. Why does stuff get picked up on electronic recording equipment, but you don't hear it? I'm sure there's plenty of discussion and writing that has been done about that, but I haven't seen it yet.
For me, one of the most interesting things I think will be is in some of the locations that we've had, some of the experiences or the emotions, the feelings that I've had. For me, it'll be interesting to see if they coincide with anything on the ADRs, or the DVRs. Uh-huh. And if there's something that's actually visual that I didn't see but actually responded to emotionally.
Audio
to
digital me, recorder, video digital
thank
recorder.
Thank you. To me, that would be very interesting.
Yeah. And that's been going on for years. I mean, they start this EVP, Paul, was first kind of discovered in the early 1950s. And it's grown to almost ridiculous proportions now, with people doing extremely ridiculous and what's the word? They read too much into a lot of things, I think. However, there are not so isolated cases of, how the hell did we get that? How the hell did we record that? Somebody finding out something is relevant to them personally, like I said, when they start paying it, it's kind of like magical working when you start paying attention to something, or just anything. Like if you have a project, you start paying attention to things, they start paying attention back to you. It's a strange thing. It's hard to describe, but yeah, now I'm getting people nodding here. This is good.
Well, and the episode that I'm most looking forward to is whenever we do pull out the Ouija board, because the skeptic in me would say, there's 20 different ways you can explain a Ouija board. It's all bunk.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I know at least a handful of people that have had very real serious – they won't even touch – I know somebody that if you bring a Ouija board into the house
– they leave.
It's like they'll leave and get that thing out of there. They won't touch it. And that was 20 years ago. This particular person had
Walter's
that experience.
Walter's nodding too.
And I had a spiritualist tell me once, he explained the Ouija board to me. He said, look, it's like leaving your house unlocked. Maybe somebody nice is going to come walk through the door, but odds are nice people will always knock. If you leave your house unlocked, it's bad people that are going to come in. And with a Ouija board, the only things that
and
are going to come in are
bad. And you
might
not be able to make them leave.
Yeah, and you might not be able to get rid of them. So Holly and I kind of joke that we're going to have to go to Peru or something up the Amazon to have some shaman cleanse us for a week or two after we're done season one.
The
I know. I just want a trip to Peru. I mean, honestly, hey. if I can go to Hoboken or Peru, I choose Peru. So yeah.
The man who taught me how to raise spirits from their graves is the one who also told me to stay the hell away from a Ouija board. So that's where I get my reticence about Ouija boards. And there's always Captain Howdy.
See, my question there is, why does the Ouija board open the door? Can you not open the door without it?
I think doors can be open. I certainly think doors can be open without it. It's just one way. But I think my understanding is it has to do with the actual origin of the thing. I mean, I know that I it's like Milton Bradley or Parker Brothers. It was something they came up with. Oh, now that's interesting. That I don't Oh, yeah, because there is the book, Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board, which, you know what's funny? I do a lot of Aleister Crowley research I have done lately. That's the one book I haven't picked up, I will not pick up. So, but it sounds like I'm going to have to now, Paul. You've cornered me. I have to look at this now.
I'm not sure that it was Crowley that invented or came up with the Ouija board. I just
No.
But I'm pretty sure he was one of the major practitioners who really pushed it into the popular consciousness.
That I doubt.
1800s, right?
Yeah, turn of the century. Into the early 20th century.
The thing was, there are things called witch boards and spirit boards that were going before that, and people have done things using. George Hunt Williamson, when he lived in Sedona, when they were trying to talk to aliens by using a...
Right.
They didn't use a Ouija board. They used a piece of paper that they said the aliens told them to design, whatever that means. It had letters on it, and they for a planchette, they used a upside-down shot glass because it slid over the paper well. And then in the early teens or the early 20s, a company started producing these on a large scale. I do not know where that... The setup came from the letters across the top and the hello and goodbye and all that, but that's based on stuff that's been going on, you know, for centuries, really.
Its origins are dark. I was
flat out told that the Ouija board's origin comes from a very dark place, a very dark source. Now, this is a man who's taught me how to go out into an old cemetery. It's got to be someone who's been dead at least 150 years at night and raise dead spirits, and told me at one point that early on when I would first see them, they would try to scare me from doing it because they're being disturbed. I said, well, what do you mean scare me? He goes, well, it'll be about 10 times worse than hair raising. You know, and yet he said, stay the hell away from a Ouija board.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, my question is why does the person have to be dead 100, 150 years? And can anyone be raised? And that would assume that everyone who's died, soul is actually still in the grave. Or is it only a few people who are still in that location?
I've done a lot of thinking on this, and he didn't really, if he explained it to me, that's not an operative part that I remember, but he said it seemed to me that have to do with something to do, I'm guessing, with physics, and here's an interesting thing about reincarnation, which Paul mentioned earlier, which I used to be a vehement opponent of, and now I wholeheartedly believe in it. There is part of a tradition that the reason some of the Eastern religions, they burn their dead, is so that they can reincarnate faster. And it might have something to do with decomposition and how long it takes before the conditions of the bones or whatever are such. But the interesting thing is the soul still in those bones in the body? Or are you – the way he described it to me, I now recall, you know, figuring this out, that what you're doing is you're drawing – their spirit to that place where their body was laid to rest. They're in another place. They don't want to be back there in the grave.
And I just want to make clear that I wasn't saying Crowley invented the Ouija board, but I think he was one of the people, and Greg and I just checked it on Wikipedia. I love the modern era. But he was one of the people who I think popularized it, or at least brought it to the greater public consciousness through his writings, which were more to do with magic and stuff like that. So
yeah, well, it was basically using the techniques of Western magic, some Eastern, I won't use his mumbo jumbo. It was basically to get reality to conform to what you want it to do for what you want.
Well, and you can come back and say, well, why does any, if you believe in this stuff, why does any mystical symbol, you know, have resonance? Well, maybe it's not the symbol. Instead of drawing X, you could draw Y. As long as the person, as long as you have faith and believe and all that sort of stuff. It's like vampires. This will sound weird, but I did do a film about vampires. So
what?
Look at that, bringing it around again. You know, the old thing where what happens if you're a Jewish vampire and you've got a guy holding up a cross to you? Just like, oy vey, I'm Jewish. What is it? And then you bite the guy. That's my Stan Friedman Catskills Jewish accent from the 1950s. Sorry. But the answer would be...
I got a guy who lives next door and he talks just like that.
There you go. The answer would normally...
I think he's a vampire.
No. The answer would normally be that it doesn't matter. A Jewish vampire would be repelled by a cross or any symbol. It's not the symbol itself.
It's the intention.
It's the intent of the believer.
Yeah.
So the same thing could be true of mystical symbols. The same thing could be true of Ouija boards. It's not the board itself. It's just a symbol that most of us recognize.
That's
and
funny.
That we use to open doors and
you
get
say
out of
that
box.
Paul. It's exactly what I was going to say when I heard Walter talking, saying, you know, using all these devices and the person has to be dead for 100 years. Maybe it has more to do with what you are doing with it than that person. That's just the model you're working with to get a result. Now, how that result comes about, you have no idea. But the model you're working with apparently, you know, for some people, produces results that they think are not due to some mundane explanation. So, yeah, I think that a lot of these things you project out have to do with your perception, the way you look at things, the things you notice, and maybe on a mystical, weird, spiritual level, how receptive your subconscious or whatever you want to call it is to these things.
And here's the crazy thing. For me, at least, going back to UFOs, I've been a frequent critic of guys like Stephen Greer, who I do think is a huckster. But a lot of these people with the contactee movement,
I agree,
where they call them down. You know, this idea that you can call UFOs, and yet. Why necessarily, depending on what a UFO may or may not be, theoretically, it may work the exact same way, that people who are willing to open themselves to seeing a UFO or experiencing something may be more likely to see a UFO or experience it. I don't think you're going to see it by paying $800 to have Stephen Greer wave a flashlight in the sky for you.
Yeah.
But in your own way, you know, you may be able to do that. And who knows? Most of the contactees, I think, still were charlatans. However, having done some research and talked to Greg and others who know more about it than I do, I'm willing to sort of say I keep an open mind about a few of them, that there may have been underlying this charlatanism of the overall contactee movement. There may have been people who had genuine experiences.
I'm surprised to hear this coming from you, Paul.
Could have opened themselves up.
This is exactly what I've been saying. How did I bring you around to this way of thinking?
I know.
I'm very persuasive. Yeah.
He does rub off on people in more ways than one. Yeah.
I need an adult.
No, the thing with contactees, and Adam Gorightly, who's probably listening, has a great lecture called "Were the Early Contactees Ritual Magicians?" Because they were aware of some of the Western occult tradition, and they were using some of this to contact whatever they thought they were contacting. Now, you know, they thought they were contacting space brothers and UFOs coming from other planets. Who knows if they were contacting something where they came from? But that, you know, this is what I've maintained for so long. That was their model for what they were contacting. Who knows what it is? It could be disembodied, you know, goo somewhere. But they chose to think it's aliens from another planet. And who knows, you know, maybe it would appear to them as such because that's exactly what they expected. You've got a mold already when it gets there.
And so with UFOs, you have the charlatans like Greer and the hucksters. But on the other hand, you have the people, there are people like, and I have a great deal of respect for them, the Jerry Clarks, the Dick Halls of the world, who are in what I would call the box. And they have put UFO research into the box. And I still feel more comfortable usually in the box than I do outside it. But I keep a door open. You'll often hear...
I feel so comfortable you'll outside often hear that
some,
box.
I know. You'll often hear some people talk about the occult influences in ufology or UFO research.
Yeah, ask Alan Greenfield.
And they sometimes will pinpoint Jacques Vallée and talk about him in particular. And I would say a lot of people misunderstand what they're saying when they say occult. They think, oh, witchcraft and stuff. No, they're talking about this, and you're talking about the contactees, this tradition of looking outside the box, which people just label occultism or whatever.
Well, yeah. A lot of people listening to the show would not be surprised to learn that Jacques Vallée does have experience with occult stuff. Is conversant with it, I believe, and has a regard for it, not to the point where he's going to say, I'm calling up aliens or anything like that, but at the point where he considers it a possibly legitimate tool, if you know what I mean, for looking into the mystery or the problem or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I would just say you're sort of left with two alternatives no matter how you want to look at it. Either we live in a world where there is no mystery, there's no magic, there's no doors outside the box, in which case, frankly, what's the point? I mean, we're just little gerbils running around in a maze. We might as well all slit our
wrists.
Well,
why not just look at history and find out that everything's outside the box moves into it after a while?
Or we live in a world where there are doors out of the box. We just, most of us choose not to step outside, and there are possibilities. That doesn't mean they exist. It just means we should keep an open mind, which is, you know, sort of, yes, I have moved more towards your way of thinking and Nick's way of thinking and Mac's way of thinking over the years.
That's all you listen to.
What?
We keep saying something different, whereas different to you and different from what the mainstream says.
But I keep you guys grounded.
I think I keep me grounded fine.
I was just doing
well, you know what you do, because people like you and a few of my other friends, they will say, oh, come on, kind of thing. And I was like, no, I have to reinforce what I'm saying and clarify my own thought process and my own way of coming to my conclusions for myself. And as I've said so many times, I haven't come to conclusions. My conclusion is, just like you said just now, there's always a box and you can look outside of it. And when I rudely interrupted you, I said, well, the box is always moving or getting bigger or getting branches on it.
Box with branches.
Yeah.
Ah!
Yes. Branches which can reach out and startle you. There's a lot of people that don't that think I run into this a lot. Somebody will say, well, we know everything there is to know. It's like, how can you say that? That's what they say. You know,
who says that? What kind of a person?
A lot of people
says that
in the late 1890s. The U.S. Patent Office was considering closing down because they said there was nothing left to be invented.
Oh my gosh, that is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard.
Didn't sound ridiculous to them.
Well, anyone who thinks that they know everything that there is to know is either clinically insane.
Well, the race knows all there is to know.
This goes into this whole idea that we create priesthoods. It used to be in ancient times that the priesthood were just the people who dealt with the beings that people thought of as gods. So then they presented themselves as, well, we're the ones that know the wills of the gods. So that's how the priesthood was created. And nowadays, it's just a priesthood of technology, a priesthood of science, a priesthood of sociology. Basically, and I don't know how it is in your guys' neck of the woods, but in the States, everybody is so obsessed with taking the word of the specialist. If you got a pedigree, if you're a specialist, that's all they need to know. Nobody thinks for themselves, and the specialists want us to believe that everything is known and they know it.
It's, well, a lot of them.
And you know,
the ones you hear from.
And the crazy thing is, if you'll take doctors, for instance, you'll find a lot of them are specialists. When I was in law school, I drank with a lot of those guys, and nobody drank more than doctors. I wouldn't trust 95% of them to diagnose a cold, much less operate on my brain or my heart or something. So this whole cult of – you're quite right, Walter – this whole cult of specialization that's grown up, there are people who really are truly talented, and when they say something – the Einsteins of the world or whatever – then we should probably listen because they know more than we do. But this – you have it absolutely right, this concept of a priesthood, because to me, the problem with spirituality is not spirituality, it's religion. And this idea that you need an intermediary between you and whatever the divine is. And that
a lot of people don't have time to do that, so they look to a so-called expert.
That is a human construct, though.
Right. And they should take the time.
If you look at the Gospels, the New Testament at least, that's not what was coming down from allegedly on high.
Right,
he's coming
right.
down saying, you can have a direct experience with me. That's what I'm here for. Now, you can believe or not believe that, but if you do believe it, why the heck do you need priests or ministers or anything like that to interpret the direct word of God? That's your job. So, and this is something
you
I
get
do.
Get down to it, and Buddha and Jesus and a lot of people say the same thing.
Well, this is what I did my graduate studies on in history, this idea 19th century evangelicalism, where they would take new light movements where people would be having direct experiences with God, and they would then formalize that, turn it in the case of the Maritimes, the Baptist Church, put a structure, put a hierarchy, put all of these impediments, you know, these things like you have to be baptized in a certain way, you have to, all of this, and you would have guys come along who would say, look, all you need is a direct experience with the divine. That's it. Everything else that's created by man, not important. And those new lights, I felt much, I'm not a religious person or even hopeful agnostic, but I would feel more kinship with that way of looking at it. Now, I think that's true of the paranormal. I don't think you need experts telling you about anything to do. For or against. And if they do, you sit back and you say, okay, Greg says this, not that we're experts. Greg says this, Walter says this, Paul says this. And then I would say, as Greg said, my blog says, don't believe, don't disbelieve, think. So take all the things that we say and everybody else says, and then go try and have that direct experience yourself, which is why I do what I do, why I want to ghost hunt.
Yeah.
So maybe I can have that experience. I sit out in the desert sometimes in New Mexico or wherever and on the hood of the car and stare up at the sky. I'd love to see a UFO go flying by. Hasn't happened yet.
And why Walter does what he does with the book he's doing now, why I did the magazine and why I want to write books, because what it is you're putting yourself through the kind of school that you wanted, nobody offered to you.
There is one other thing I wanted to say, too, about this idea of it's all over, we know everything. There was a historian, a pretty good one, Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book after the Cold War, The End of History. That's what he called it.
Yeah.
You know, the Cold War is over, it's the end of history, which has to be the most arrogant thing that any historian has ever said. Now, he didn't mean it quite like that. Right. What he really sort of meant is the end of a period of history that we kind of understood as this great power. But still, the very phrase, the end of history, like we've only sort of had recorded history for 2,000 or 3,000 years.
The end of history is when the asteroid hits.
Yeah, boom, we're all gone. and so this idea that we've...
end of ours, anyway.
And this gets around to UFO studies, too. This idea that we've accumulated all knowledge. You hear this from true debunkers, the fundamentalist type. They say, you can't get from Zeta Reticuli to here because we don't know how to do it. And if we don't know how to do it because we're scientists, if we can't figure it out, surely nobody else could have figured it out because we're the most advanced beings on the planet. Or in the universe. And when you hear them talk like that, they remind it's anti-scientific, because what they really are the priests and the bishops of the Catholic Church talking to guys like Galileo. And they're saying, if we don't know it, this is the way the universe is ordered in our world. If we can't do it, we don't understand it, it can't possibly be true. And so what you wind up doing today is burning people at metaphorical stakes and shunting them off, guys like Dean Radin, to the corners of the world outside the scientific establishment, because they're saying things that may or may not be true. Who knows? But they're curious. And curiosity is something that is frowned on in today's society, unfortunately. Right. And that's all I'm going to say, because thus endeth my preaching. And don't believe a word I just said. Check for yourself.
That's funny. I'll sign books at... conferences, Project Beta, and what I write in is don't believe everything you read on my book. Yeah. And that
I wouldn't believe everything I read in that book.
But it's just an example. I'm not trying to be egotistical about it. It's just, and the where I got that from, the very first thing, that little dawning of, hey, maybe the people that are telling us stuff might be full of shit. Like Patton Oswalt. I don't think that's true.
There's two things I knew. Chewbacca was real, and black people didn't kill you for your cell phones.
Exactly. I had a tempestuous time in my life, and a lot of things went wrong. I was very depressed, and I wanted to kill myself, literally. I wanted to commit suicide. And I read a book called – and it has nothing to do with really how I was feeling, but it made me realize that there was still something I did not know, and not to listen to everybody. It was called The New Inquisition, the Robert Anton Wilson book, which everybody listening to this show has probably read. And if they haven't, they should. It basically, what Wilson does throughout this book is first tell you people who are experts, don't listen to people who are experts, because experts are wrong too. And he proves this to you by putting a bunch of tests in front of you about, he like does these long, you know, not long, maybe 20 questions on a test and says, what's the answer to this? Water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 degrees centigrade. You say, oh, yes. And then in a small, you know, just to show you, you know, somebody has told you this, well, it doesn't freeze at 32 degrees Celsius. I mean, no, boils at 212 degrees or 100 degrees Celsius, but it doesn't boil at 100 degrees Celsius at 5,000 feet. But just to show you that if you make a snap judgment about something because something you've been taught and haven't thought it through and haven't looked far enough, that's a very bad example, but that's just one of his very easy examples. that, yes, there is yet more to know. And no, when somebody who claims to know more than you tells you that something is an absolute, you should always question that politically, scientifically, philosophically, everything, and find out for yourself. And that's, you know, that's what we try to, you know, I try to spread that word. Everybody I know tries to do that. And we do that on this show. Walter does it. Paul does it. He just described it. And Holly has joined us doing the same thing. And it's wonderful. 213-252-0998.
I do think you should question. Absolutely. There's a couple of things. I mean, someone who's got a medical degree, no, you shouldn't believe them 100% of the time. Absolutely not. You should question if you think that there's something wrong there. Yeah. But
you can go too far,
someone
though.
Who's been a doctor, I mean, my God, I mean, I didn't study medicine for 8 years. So, yeah, I'm going to defer to their expertise on several occasions. And that's not that you shouldn't believe doctors. But, yeah, if you think that there's something wrong, you think that you sure question it. Absolutely. On all levels. But, I mean, don't be an ass about it either.
Yeah. Well, then you end up being somebody that questions everything to the point where you don't know what to think anymore. Or you make up your own mind regardless of what people tell you. That's, you know, that's going completely in the other direction.
Well, you could do that if you really wanted to. But
no,
I
but
mean,
then you become a doctrinaire, you know, person of your own religion and become almost even more annoying than the people that are saying they're experts.
Well, exactly.
But when you have a medical system that is pharmaceutical companies are paying doctors, in essence, payola to prescribe pills as the default mechanism for curing everything, then maybe you don't just question your own doctor, who may be a man or woman of good conscience. You should be questioning the entire system at that point. So it's not just an individual, it's the system. And it's also the system that trained them, too. And coming through that system, how many of them still retain the capacity for true independent thinking?
You know what amazes
me? So
one
always
time?
Get a second opinion. That would be my advice.
I can't remember what it was. I think I had back pain or some kind of pain. And the doctor I went to said, well, you can do these exercises. You can take these pills. And she also said, also, you can try acupuncture. And I went, what? This was at Cedars-Sinai. A very big, very respected. And I said, why did you, you know, my head starts spinning. How could you even suggest something like that being a doctor? I wasn't closed-minded to, but a doctor, a medical doctor with a degree from a university tells me this.
Ah. Why is that a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing.
Okay,
I was amazed by it.
Okay, good.
We've got a caller. It's the American Medical Association.
No, 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 no. Just a second. It is, isn't it?
Yes, it's Carlos.
I knew it. Carlos the Jackal.
It's Carlos the Jackal. Can you hear us there?
Yes, I can.
Hey, let me turn you up a bit. There we go.
Yeah, we're getting all evangelical and jumping up and down, and I knew somebody would call. Yeah, we're getting too full of ourselves. You better take us down a peg, Carlos. Did you want to take us down a peg, or did you want to say hallelujah?
Hallelujah. to a certain extent.
Okay. What is the qualifier on your hallelujah?
The qualifier on hallelujah is that there are certain.
Sorry.
There's not so much experts out there, but there are people who are knowledgeable and who have a good reputation for being knowledgeable about a lot of different subjects who don't average that. And those are the people you should seek out, the secret gurus who fly underneath the radar. There's lots of guys out there that you'll find them that are extremely knowledgeable over a wide range of subjects, right?
Yes.
Or maybe even one subject.
Yeah.
But you have to find them. They're not going to go out there and advertise themselves as
exactly
the expert on this. But they are guys sitting out there like Walter, several other people that you have worked with. They have a knowledge on possibly a broad range of subjects, or maybe just a single subject. But they are the ones, they're keeping it secret largely because they know the implications of revealing the extent of their knowledge might cause them grief.
Well, there's another step. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Or it might cause them either grief or peril.
Yeah. Well, there's another level to this. The thing is that you have to trust your judgment.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you can listen to whoever you want or listen, you know, but you have to trust you and think for yourself and trust your own judgment. And that may be the yardstick. It comes down to you, unfortunately, you know. Scares a lot of people, but scares me sometimes.
Sorry for lack of better things, right? It's that old, there's an old thing, you know, call it intuition, whatever. Gut instinct will often tell you something's funny. Listen to your gut. You know, and too many people have been taught you need to, like you said, you need to seek out an expert instead of just saying, and when you get to the expert and he tells you a load of crap, and you're like, instead of saying, well, he's an, you know, people have this self-doubt that say, he's, and don't, like you said, don't believe everything you read, but there's a lot of stuff that there's no other choice, because there's no other, if you go to some of these so-called experts, they're going to fill you full of shit. You know, they're going to throw a bunch of shit at you that's full of, you know, it's full of crap. You know, you're like, what the heck is this? You know, you're dead wrong. I've already gone down this path, and you're, you know, that's where, you know, you have to be selective about who you're getting your knowledge from.
Yeah, yeah. You're back to your instrument. Your yardstick is your own experience and your intellectual capacity. Yes.
But too many folks go out there and they are either lazy or they're fearful of looking ignorant or dumb, or you know, so they follow these gurus, you know, and the gurus are idiots. I've talked to a couple of them, and there's a few of them out there that you know, in my shooting sport, there's two or three guys that I trust their knowledge. They say something was good, I trust them implicitly. But there's a bunch of other guys out there that are just so full of crap, it's unreal.
Yeah, those who know don't say, those who say don't know, yeah.
Yeah, and but you have to selectively mind those people, or be lucky and stumble across them. Otherwise, you're going to end up, God, the ghost thing is just, you know, I don't even want to go there.
Holly, were you reaching for the microphone there?
Oh, yeah, sure, at one point.
You have to kind of hold this so he can hear what you're saying.
I was just going to say that I absolutely agree with you, and I think it really comes down to that if someone's explaining something to you and they're not making it logical, it doesn't seem rational, if it doesn't make sense, it's a good possibility that maybe it doesn't make sense. Maybe it's not true. Maybe it's not real.
Well, there's also some things. See, the problem is, you made up a very good point, and the big thing is that some things, people are looking for simple answers to complex questions, and when they don't get the complex question, the simple answers they're looking for, they think everybody's full of shit. You know, that's the caveat to the your bullshit meter going off, and that's what people don't understand. They're trying to too many people out there right now, which is why we're in the condition we're in the world. Is they're looking for simple answers to complex systems or complex problems, and that's not what they want. They want the quick and dirty. They want the quick and dirty. And it just drives me nuts when I see that, when it's applied to not just politics or just about anything. You know, until you get out there and try something for yourself, or go out and explore something for yourself. See, that's the problem. You know, the one thing that Paul mentioned earlier is that, you know, we've been taught not to be curious. You know, if you go looking in places that you're not supposed to, or looking for things, or questioning things that you're not supposed to question, you're some sort of heretic or pariah or something like that. Oh, shut up. Can't you see that this is Dr. Fantastic or whatever? You know, and you're like, you know, he can be just as full of prunes as everybody else. they look 100 years ago, take geology, for instance. You know, wasn't that your, did you say you had a degree in geology or something like that?
Biology.
Biology. Look at biology. Oh,
sure.
God, 25, look in the last 30 years.
I know.
It's scary. It's absolutely scary.
Absolutely. So it boggles my mind when people actually go, we know everything there is to know right now. Are you crazy?
I think the caveat to that when they say that is we know how to find out there is everything to know. We have the methods for finding out every secret there ever was. We just have to keep it the same method. I think that's the the message.
Hi, Carlos. It's I was just going to say, hi, Carlos. It's Paul here. I just want to say, I want to make sure everybody understands that I'm not a leveler. I don't believe that everybody's equal. Some people are smarter than other people. Some people do know more than other people. And some of it's natural talent, but some of it is also you just go out there and you make an effort to be informed. So just as I would criticize the self-proclaimed experts or specialists or whatever, I would also criticize those people who just sit the sort of Jerry Springer generation that just sit back and, you know, say, you know what, I don't have to learn anything. Here's what I believe. This is what I don't know what I'm talking
He's
about.
He's using the Southern accent, you noticed.
Well, yeah, it's the Southern Baptist. You know, you've had a president for 8 years who basically epitomizes that. You know, I don't need to know the facts. I just believe this is, you know, like I feel it. And that's not what the Republic is founded on. The Republic was founded by men like Jefferson.
I've got this idea about quantum physics I want you to hear about. Well, nobody would have listened to him.
Would have been quantum physics.
Listen to this Canadian fella talking about our Republic like that.
Hey.
My ancestors come from this Republic. They were instrumental in forming it. The idea that you would be Renaissance men or women, that you would read, you would inform yourself, and part of it is they've put us, whoever they are. My dad always said, "Be careful about using the term they." In this case, they, society, whatever, has put us in a box. But we've allowed ourselves to be put in that box quite comfortably as well, through various opiates of the masses, as Marx would have said. And you know, instead of sitting at home and playing your Xbox for the entire day. Or and I like a good video game too, but instead of just taking the easy way out and doing all these things that are foisted upon you that people tell you through advertising, hey, play Xbox or whatever, or spending all your time watching TV, read a book or do what Holly and I are doing if you can, even if not on television, because I don't need the competition. But you know, there's books on haunted inns. If you're interested in ghosts, there's at least one good one in Prescott, Arizona. I know I've been there. And when you're done in Prescott, drive up to Williams, Arizona, and stay at the Red Garter Inn. It's supposedly haunted, too. You can do these kind of things. Build a vacation around it. Read. Inform yourself. Then you'll have my respect, even if I disagree with you. If you haven't done those things, if you haven't made an effort to inform yourself or experience, then I don't want to talk to you and I don't want to hear from you. And if that sounds harsh, too bad. Because that's the flip side of the sort of anti-self-proclaimed expert thing that I have. And that's the anti-idiot thing that I have. And those idiots are all those people that don't make an effort to get out of the box.
Well, and are loud about it.
And are loud and obnoxious about it. And you can see it on the Steve Wilkos show.
So people who talk really loud about things, they have no idea what they're talking about?
Like me!
No, they do have an idea what they're talking about, but they're pig-headedly stupid about it, where they will not listen to anybody else.
Oh, I hate that.
Yes.
Closed-minded.
Stupidity combined with obnoxiousness is about the worst. Just obnoxious is okay, I suppose. Just stupid is fine, but combine the two, and I'm out of there.
Absolutely. Keep an open mind. Learn what you can learn. I mean, it's hard.
By the way, we're almost 40 minutes over our normal show time.
Yay!
Just to info everybody there, I lived with a ghost for 2 years.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I lived in a haunted building in Mildenhall, England, for 2 years with a ghost.
How was that?
It was weird at times.
Define weird.
At times he would. I have a black hat that, you know, looks. When I put it on, I look sort of dangerous looking, and the ghost would move the hat around the house from where I laid it.
Yeah. Did you actually see them move the hat around?
No, but I know I had a certain place that I would put the hat whenever I came in, and it was just habit. I do things by habit. I was in the military for 20 years, and you do things by habit, and I would put it in a certain place, and I'd come back 30 minutes later, and the hat is moved.
Now, did you have an explanation for why this paranormal entity would want to move your hat?
No, but it was strange. There was just, it was a strange place. I lived in it. It was a very old building. It was 500, 600 years old.
Whoa.
We think of old being 100, 150 years in the States. It's nothing. If you go over to Europe, There's been hauntings all over Europe for thousands of years.
And so this spirit, did you able to find out maybe who it was at one point?
I later learned that, yeah, the building has been haunted for years. They don't know by who or by what, and I told them what they were doing. He says, that sounds familiar. That sounded about what had happened. Things like that happened a lot. We had an empty apartment, or flat, as they call them, upstairs from me, and I would hear what sounded like a cat inside, and I would go up, and I asked the people I was renting from that I was renting from a charity shop, and they said, you might want to go let that cat out upstairs. He says, there's no cat. And he says, well, I hear it every night. He says, and the little lady says, that's the ghost cat that lives up there.
A ghost cat. Now, that is very interesting, because then you would have to assume that the cat had a spirit, and that just throws everything on
your back. Well, you could assume that.
There's all sorts of tales of ghost dogs and ghost critters.
That's ghost possums.
True. I haven't really spoken to anyone who's actually experienced it.
Yeah, I would listen to the. It would sounded like it was jumping down and running across. It sounded like a cat chasing a ball.
It sounded like a cat.
It was like it was. You'd hear it. It would jump. You'd hear it pounce, like a thump on the floor, and then you'd hear it running across the floor, like it was chasing a ball or a mouse or something.
A ghost mouse.
Ghost cat chasing ghost mouse. Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to let you guys go get pie.
Yeah, we're going for pie. Well, thanks so much for calling, Carlos.
Bye, Carlos.
Thanks, Carlos.
Anytime, Greg.
All right, I'll talk to you soon. I'll be back here next week, and you can call in then, too.
Who's your guest?
I don't know yet. I really don't know. Sometimes I don't know until a few days before.
Okay, just post it up on the Mystic.
Good night, Carlos.
Later.
Yeah, we'll be back. See you, Carlos.
Bye.
Night. No, what Walter is asking, if we'll be back. Yes, we will be back. China Lake is over at 4:30. It takes 3.5 hours to get back.
We may not be back.
Well, we will be back, and we'll try and make at least part of the show. How's that? On Radio Mysterioso. Go ahead.
I was going to say the military-industrial complex is going to have Walter Bosley, Greg Bishop, and Adam Gorightly all in one spot on their base. We may never be back.
Hoorah. Yeah, at a naval weapons testing center.
Nice.
And that would be horrible if you guys didn't come back.
And Paul says with a smile, a smirk and a smile.
Now hosting Radio Mysterioso, Holly Stevens and Paul Kimball.
Booyah.
Any more specific plugs you would like to do for projects? And Holly, too.
Eternal Kiss or Darkest Hour, which Eternal Kiss is a working title. Darkest Hour might be the title. The vampire
because
film.
Eternal Kiss is a title of another vampire, yeah. That I noticed.
Holly is one of the stars. I directed and wrote and produced. We're in post-production now. We have a distributor in the United States. Keep an eye out for it sometime in mid-2009. And hopefully the next one down the pike for me will be a film adaptation of Doing Time, the play that Mac Tonies and I co-wrote, which is based on a short story, a sci-fi short story that Mac wrote about 10 years ago. That we did at the Boulder International Fringe this past fall. Summer. So yeah. Hopefully we'll be shooting that in 2009. One of the reasons I'm in L.A. is to talk about that with some people. So keep an eye out for that. That's sort of what I got coming on the horizon. And maybe, again, hopefully, well, we're very close, a documentary, Best Evidence, Top 10 Monsters. So creatures delving into the cryptozoological world in the same way that I looked at the top 10 UFO cases. So that hopefully will be coming in 2009. And Nick Redfern would be working with us, my good friend Nick, on that project. Now Holly will plug Holly.
Oh, good. Let me see. Well, aside from doing the Ghost Hunters series, which we're currently working on and having tons of fun with, the potentials on the horizon would include would be a screenplay version of Julianne McClain's Adam's Promise, award-winning romance novel. Hopefully going to get something with that one.
and another film, feature film, a psychological thriller called Unwritten. Very, very interesting, written by my brother, actually, co-written, and basically deals with a group of university students who start researching the occult and finding out this particular weapon transfers people's souls and writes them down into books. Basically,
the death weapon, the weapon that kills people.
Not quite. Not quite.
The book that reads.
The book that reads people, yeah.
Anyway, those are potentials that are on the horizon at this point in time.
Cool. I have potentials too, but I'm not going to talk about them because it'll suck the energy right out of me.
The hope, by the way, folks, for anyone who's still listening, is that on all of my projects, Greg Bishop will always have a place in the Red Star Empire. In a difficult shoot. We haven't talked about the film, even though we said we would. So this is all
I don't. You know what? I really didn't want to talk about it that much because we would start complaining and laughing about a bunch of stuff that nobody else experienced.
Know. I don't want to talk about the bad stuff. All I would say, it was a difficult shoot, as all shoots are. But one of the things that really made it fun, kept it fun, was having Greg there. So, Greg,
really?
Greg will always have a place in the Red Star Empire because he kept all the craziness away from me until he left to get married. And which is why
then
the last
it all
six
jumped right on
the
you.
Last 6 days, it was like getting hijacked. Yeah, it's like, oh my God. So I have a whole new degree of respect for Greg.
Well, thank you.
Because he had to deal with all that stuff.
And like I said, I can't, once I've been taken out of this round of go to the job every day. I talked to John Shirley, who's I used to talk to him quite a bit, a cyberpunk writer, Mac, knows him very well. I went to a party one day. There was a guy named Tim, God, I can't remember his last name. Mac would know. I was on a night shift and I said, oh, I got to go to work now. And they both said, oh God, I'm so sorry. I said, well, you know, why? They said, we can't have a normal job. I said, why not? He said, we just can't. And I couldn't get my mind around that. Well, you got to have a normal job once in a while just to like, no, they just couldn't. And I'm starting, and now, you know, 10 years later, I'm starting to see anytime I get near a normal job, I start feeling physically ill.
Yeah. So do I. by the way, on the last note on the plugging thing, two things.
So I got to plug away at trying to get that going.
I always plug my own stuff, and I sometimes forget my friends. I'm executive producing two documentaries too.
Oh, yeah.
The great thing about executive producing is you're in the business long enough, people will pay you just to put your name on something.
Yeah.
So that's nice. One of which is a film called Colors of Exile for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It's about a Palestinian artist. Who was put into exile, I think, about 50 years ago after the Israelis took over what the Palestinians consider as Palestine. And he's now a Canadian citizen. It's made by a friend of mine, Tarek Abu Amin, who was the DP on Eternal Kiss. It's going to be a wonderful film. Should be out early in 2009. And the other one that Holly's brother is working on, and Holly's working on too, a company called Dreamfront Entertainment is doing a film again for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation called Titanic's Unknown Child. It's about the Titanic, and it's also a wonderful story as they try and resolve one of the few mysteries left from the Titanic. 100 years later, still a mystery, and hopefully these guys, I think, are going to solve it. Is that how it's going down, Holly? She knows more than I do. But anyway,
and if they don't, they'll come up with something.
Three guys in this company called Dreamfront, Steve McLean, Ben Stevens, and Josh Young, and they're all working on this film. They're shooting it now, and it's going to be a very good documentary for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Wow.
So hopefully both of those will wind their way down into the United States sooner rather than later.
Oh, I thought Holly's about to say something. Okay. Thank you for doing it. Walter, is something you want to plug?
Plug time!
No.
Okay. Walter plugs away enough at this show, so... Uh-oh, what happened to Paul's microphone? Did you turn it off?
I didn't. No, sorry. I've also this is the first time I'll announce it. I've been signed on to direct the next Batman film.
Oh, well, excellent.
Christopher Nolan is out. I'm in, and it's going to be called The Joker's Wild.
Well, you know what? I'm going to come and help because all you have to do is say, this guy's going to help. Then all you have to do is hand me, like, you know, $100,000, and I'll stay out of your way.
Holly's playing Harley Quinn. We're just going to rename her Holly Quinn.
Holly Quinn, yeah.
Oh, my.
Paul wanted to hear... and you know what? Yes, now we're going for pie. Thank you so much, Holly and Paul, for coming on the show. coming down to visit. I always like having Paul down. Always stuff to talk about. You know, when you visit friends, there's stuff you just cannot talk about on the phone or by email or whatever. In person, it's so much different. It's wonderful. Somebody's calling. We'll let that go.
Nobody ever calls.
No? Okay.
Answer the phone.
No.
Yes. Uh-oh. Hey.
Who? So Greg's on the phone talking right now, and I think it could very well be the Canada Revenue Agency who have discovered I'm now on the radio. They've tracked me down.
So that's why you're here.
Exactly. I'm a tax refugee from from Canada, hiding out in the United States.
You might want to clarify that you really aren't actually doing the next Batman movie.
No, I am doing the next Batman movie.
No, you're not, Paul.
I am. I dreamt about it last night.
That doesn't...
I dreamt I was... And actually, this is cool. I'm also going to be directing the feature film version of Wicked, the
excellent
great musical that's out there with the two witches, the good one and the sort of good one who gets misunderstood. Anyway, I'm doing that, and I'm also playing both roles, the White Witch and the Green Witch.
Are you going to do a Marion Cooper and shoot both films, Batman and Wicked, on the same set?
Exactly. It's going to be like doing Debbie Does Dallas, the remake, but doing the alt porn version and the regular porn version. And I'm going to do both, though.
Oh, the show has taken a new low.
It's what it all comes down to.
Yeah.
The low.
Yeah. So watch for that. The new Batman film, Joker's Wild, and also the theatrical adaptation of Wicked, the feature film adaptation, which I'm going to be doing. It's going to be big. I'm playing both roles, and you know what? Tom Cruise is going to be in it. We've got Tom Cruise. I'm here right now working with the Scientologists on getting Tom Cruise inked on that, and we walked right by
today, and we're absolutely very close on that. So that's the big news there. Greg is still talking on the phone. I don't know what he's talking about.
He's talking to the mystery man.
Oh, who was that?
Somebody wants to make an announcement for the station.
Okay. Hello. We're heading back to Greg now.
Yeah, it's been Radio Misterioso. DJ Chicken Leather called in and asked me to make an announcement. There's going to be a protest tomorrow at 3rd and Berendo for Dante's Stories. Well, the guy's name was Dante. He was a Jamaican immigrant that apparently there was what people say is an illegal police action where this guy started running away and then was shot in the back and then shot in the face, unarmed. So, 3rd and Berendo, 6 o'clock tomorrow. If you want to show your support meet other listeners from Kill Radio and keep an eye on the LAPD. I've had some choice words about the LAPD over the many years on this show, and this continues that tradition. Anyway, thanks so much, Paul and Holly, both for coming down to the show, and Walter again, of course. I hope you'll be back soon. We can do this again.
I would love to.
Enjoyed it very much. Paul wanted to hear a gringo like me.
Yes. Yes. Woohoo! Then have pie.
Yes, and then have pie. Composed by Ennio Morricone, and I can't remember for which movie. Do you remember?
It was a Western. By the way, I'm going to be directing the new version of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly in 2010.
Paul's doing everything. Well, at least it's before 2012.
It's true. Yep. Got to squeeze a lot in.
Adam Gorightly is retiring, he says, in 2012. I said, you idiot! So you won't be able to...
Peter Kirsten.
Yeah, well, Peter Kirsten's retiring by his own choice permanently. This song's for Paul, and this show will be available for download. I'm going to get my rear end gear for the Radio Misterioso site, since the RadioForAll.net site is as in the past been extremely unreliable. I've also got a link so that I can download these shows for my home and not have to come down here and make it available to you to access whenever you want. Podcasts will be up, etc. So thanks for listening to December 7th, 2008 edition of Radio Misterioso, Pearl Harbor Day, when all Japanese businesses in Hawaii close.
Nice.
Yes. We'll be back next week, Walter and I, probably slightly late. And if we're not, you will understand. But before the end of the year, we're trying to get some more good interviews in here. Because I, you know what, I really enjoy the music, but I also enjoy the interviews quite a lot, and I notice people keep asking about the interviews. So we're going to have to bow to popular sentiment and do that. Anyway, here's a gringo like me, and see you soon here on Radio Mysteriosa at killradio.org.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me.
Stay tuned for my new album, 2009, A Gringo Like Me, with Johnny Cash.